Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Thanks, everyone, for being here on a Friday morning. I appreciate it. I'm hoping we can kind of move through the discussion and the amendments, and I'm guessing maybe people don't want to be here all day, but we've got the room reserved, so go in.
All day.
All day and evening, so we'll do whatever is required. With that, Mr. Heller, if you want to come forward. We had one additional person who wished to testify yesterday, and we weren't able to get him in because of House floor session, but I did promise he will be able to present first thing this morning. Mr. Heller, you're recognized for 2 minutes. Please provide your testimony.
Yes, Chair. I was wondering if I could provide these handouts. I had two, if I could.
Yeah, we can hand them to the page, and he'll pass them out for us.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. My name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the people that are twice exceptional and quite disabled, sometimes called variable learners now. Come to speak on House File 890. The handouts I have today may be very hard to understand. However, I provided to a few other members ahead of time, perhaps so you can understand it. But anyways, the blue sheets are from the auditor's report this year about the MCAs. The white sheets is Minnesota Department of Education. It's the second page. That one is a partnership that the Minnesota Department of Education has with Lexel manufacturer. The yellow sheets are a question from the department last year. They answered half the question regarding Lexel. The other one, hopefully, we can get answered today if it's relevant or not to this meeting. The pink sheets are from the procedural manuals, and then the peach color sheets is one is the No Child Left Behind waiver from 2012, and another pink sheet is a presentation they did at the Senate Finance Committee, January 20, 2013. Some of the documents that I have the NAEP, the orange sheet data regarding fourth and eighth grade plummeting growth levels. So again, I'd like to talk on this bill. I don't gonna have time to tell a story, but the question has to go through the chair. If the chair's willing to yield for the Department of Education, I have one specific question as it relates to equivalencies with the GEDs, which are gonna, the numbers in there are gonna be repealed. And what does it mean to read proficient beyond eighth grade? And I don't know if the chair's willing to yield that question, but that's basically a nutshell. I can go through the document by page. I have marked the pages specifically, but may not have time to answer those questions or apply that. So first of all, is the Department of Education, I've given him a clue already, if he's willing to come and speak about this, if he wanted to come down and just answer that one question.
Mr. Heller, thank you. Your time is, well, I let you go over, and we don't have time to have a dialogue with the department, but I would encourage you to do that offline, and thank you very much for your testimony.
I've always stressed before, Chair, thank you, that I'm not here to micromanage this place, but to make people aware. But for the record, Minnesota, since the department hasn't announced the second question. It was through your chair last year. Thank you, Chair, for that question. Half of it was answered. If Minnesota moved their reading level up by three grade levels, and then I believe perhaps that's a question you can entertain, but frankly, if they move the GEDs or the grad assessments down to eighth grade, really, what is the equivalency? Because when we repeal levels for proficiency in the grad, and now we're going to repeal the rule for the GED. What do we really have was considered proficient, be college and career ready. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heller. All right, members. Do we have minutes? All right. So we have minutes in the pockets. Representative Murphy, would you like to move adoption of the minutes?
I move adoption.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Discussion? All right. All in favor of Representative Murphy's motion to approve the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Murphy. And all right. So, members, I know there's tax committee is going on, and so Ms. Keynes is getting texts from the committee administrator to let us know about votes. They're about to vote in tax committee. So if you're on the tax committee would like to go up to vote, please go on up. And with that, we will go ahead and begin with amendments to the bill. I have some comments, but I think I'll save those for at the end regarding the bill as proposed. I guess, is there any other questions? Mr. Adrian has provided us with an updated spreadsheet, which I think everyone has received. In anticipation of the question, the district runs are still being worked on, so we do not have those today. But Mr. Strom is there working on them. Any other questions about materials or that a member would like to close before we turn to amendments? Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I've been on this committee for 17 years, and while my memory is never what I would like it to be, I think this is the first time that the committee has marked up a bill without district runs. And, you know, there's two parts to our title of state representative, and part of our obligation is to step back and look at the whole state, and we can do that with this bill. But part of our obligation also is to look out for our local district and districts like ours. And we don't have the information we need. I'm concerned that we're rushing through a bill without then adequate information, certainly for the members, but also for the public to understand what's the impact of this bill on my kid's school, on my community schools.
Well, I have not been here 17 years. I've been here 9. I guess I don't remember if we had district runs always when we did markup. I'm trying to recall 2 years ago. I know we had them when we went to the floor, but I'm not certain that we had them by markup. But Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, there have been years, I don't remember which, but there have certainly been years over the last 25-some years where the runs have not been available at this stage of the markup. What I'm hoping is that before committee ends today, we'll have a general education run that's available that will have some limitations. But what we find is, as our ability to put more and more things on the spreadsheet happens, the runs have gotten more and more complicated. So what I hope to have before you leave today is a general education change for 18 and 19 with several simplifying assumptions. And Madam Chair, if you'll permit me, the areas where we're having trouble showing the effects are primarily backing out the voluntary pre-kindergarten from each of the formulas in the right proportions. And showing the MCA modification to the targeted compensatory revenue, which needs to be calculated at the site level using essentially an average of the MCA scores, which can be several for some of the facilities. So what I'm hoping to have here in just a little bit will be general education revenue showing the 1.5% change and showing the compensatory change, assuming all the districts got the full 100% of the targeted compensatory revenue, but I don't think there's a chance I'm going to be able to figure out the voluntary pre-kindergarten on the runs today. It's complicated because the ratio of compensatory for the voluntary pre-K is quite a bit different than on that sort of average basis. So to tie out to Ms. Adrian's spreadsheet, we want to make sure that the run's in good enough shape that they look somewhat similar. So I apologize to the committee, but we hopefully will have some paper in front of us soon.
Thank you.
Well,
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, MDE was good enough to provide us with a map yesterday of all the districts. The ones in blue currently have voluntary pre-K programs that Mr. Fromm indicated are ones that they're having trouble modeling on the spreadsheet. All of these districts in blue are going to lose that funding under your bill. And none of the districts in green that have applied for that funding for this coming year, I believe it's 269 districts that have applied, if my memory is correct. We visited on that question a moment ago. None of them will receive that money. That seems to be, that alone is a significant element that I think a number of members of this committee would probably like to know how it's going to affect them. The changes in compensatory are meaningful to, I think there's over 300 districts in the state that receive compensatory funding. I guess I want to put on the table the question of why don't we, the deadline isn't for a week. Other finance committees are meeting next week to mark up those their bills. Why not allow the public and the members full information before we proceed on this bill, adjourn and reconvene someday next week?
Representative Dabney, we are going to proceed with the bill today. I understand your concerns. I know that nonpartisan staff is working as quickly and as accurately as they can to get that information to the members, and we will provide it just as soon as it is available. The bill will still have a number of stops along the way in the process. Again, we're going to proceed as planned today. I think your concerns are duly noted, and I think we'll just have to be patient as staff is working through this request to make sure that members have the information.
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Just to that point, I'm not going to debate whether we're going to proceed or not today, but I have found it troubling in the last couple years that whenever we ask questions about the timing of things and things happening, that there's a tendency to point to our nonpartisan staff as opposed to taking responsibility ourselves. As Representative Dabney said, we have a whole week before this deadline happens. So, you know, last year when the tax bill had a $100 million mistake, nonpartisan staff, not Greg Davids, was to blame. When there was a $1 billion mistake in the bonding bill because we waited till an hour before session ended to actually deliver a bonding bill, it wasn't the leadership in the House Republican Caucus. It was nonpartisan staff that was to blame. So please don't try to put your decision to proceed today and our inability to get information on nonpartisan staff.
Representative Thiessen, let me be crystal clear about this. This is no fault on the part of nonpartisan staff.
Then why did you mention that?
I said that they are working as quickly as they can to produce the information, just to make it clear that they are. I agree. I think our deadlines are incredibly aggressive. I wish we had more time, but we have a timeline that this committee has been instructed to meet, and so it's our responsibility to meet it. So
I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you.
I think it's important for committee members to know that I have nothing but the greatest respect for the work ethic of our nonpartisan staff. They have been incredible through a very difficult a short period of time to work on this bill. Have been doing a wonderful, professional, admirable job. And so I think it's important that I recognize that. I'm sure all committee members do. So just to be clear about that. Other questions just overall on the materials procedurally before we turn to amendments? All right, seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and offer the first amendment. It's number 12, so it says the initials in the top corner are KRB-HART, HART, the number 12. And this is just the forecast adjustment. It's a procedural amendment. I'll turn to Mr. Strong just to fully explain it.
Madam Chair, members, one part of the bill each year is the forecast adjustment article. As members may know, each pupil-funded formula in the K-12 area is essentially required to be fully funded so that when this committee passes a general education allowance or some other allowance, it's the best guess at the time for pupil counts. The formula needs to be fully funded, and then the agreement that the legislature and management and budget have is that in the subsequent year, if that forecast shows more or less pupils and these dollar amounts change, that the legislature goes back and adjusts those appropriations. So this essentially ties the bill back out to the base that's in the forecast. There's not an procedural advantage to increasing or decreasing any of these numbers. This is just making the numbers correspond to the forecast. No aid is booked as an increase, no savings as a decrease because of these changes. So, for example, committee members, on line 1.10 of this document, you can see that because the forecast predicted slightly more pupils to finish fiscal year 17, that the appropriation is up by $30 million or thereabouts. That's automatically adjusted for, and this forecast article is simply the technical tool we use to ensure that those adjustments tie out. So, Madam Chair, that's what the forecast adjustment article is. Ms. Adrians and I would be happy to talk with any member if they have specific questions on why a particular number changed.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Strom, and and I too was uncomfortable with the earlier thing. I don't think you need to apologize ever to this committee. I've never met a harder worker, working nonpartisan staff person than you, and so I want to thank you for your work. I think I follow that, but I'm not Mr. Finance tech person here. So why don't you walk me through, if you will, quickly, and it might be repetitive what you just said, but it'd be helpful for me. On page 3 on the achievement integration, 8 on lines 3.24 and 3.25, that's a pretty substantive, numerical change. So I suspect it's a repetition, but I learned by repetition. If you could walk me through that again, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. So on page 3, starting on line 3.19, this is the appropriation from the 2015 session that was modified last year as well. The formula for integration revenue hasn't changed, but the number of underlying students that are participating in districts that have an approved plan has changed for two reasons. One, that there's a couple of different districts participating than what we expected back in 2015 when the legislature first passed this appropriation. And then secondly, there may be fewer or more students in each of those districts participating as well. So, for example, if the St. Paul School District were serving 200 pupils less than for fiscal year 17 than what we expected a year ago, their integration revenue, which is set at a dollars per pupil amount, would go down by that 200 pupils times the formula, and so that reduction would show up here. So there's no change to the underlying formula. The statutory formula still calculates the money in the exact same way. The integration formula is based on both the percent students of color and the total students in the district, and so any change in either of those or in a district applying or not applying to have a plan approved would cause that number to change. But essentially, estimates of pupil counts, and for the rest of the bill this year, we're estimating the student count for next year and 2019 as well, both well out into the future, and anything that changes the number of pupils will affect these numbers as well. So really what's happening is the forecast provides us additional information, and the legislature then adjusts the appropriation to tie out to the formula. So the formula matches the forecast at all times, essentially, is what happens here. And there's no change, and this doesn't save the committee $2 million to spend, nor on the front page where the general ed appropriation went up by $30 million, did this committee have to pay for it. Instead, those are formula-driven amounts, and they simply are changed here to correspond to what the forecast estimates.
That's very helpful. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions on the Part 12 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Forecast amendment is adopted. All right. Next, members, I'd like to turn to the author's amendment, the A47 amendment. In your packets. Okay. Either Mr. Strom or Ms. Adrians, if you want to just walk through the provisions.
Madam Chair, why don't Ms. Pera and I quickly walk through the changes here in the author's amendment? I'll basically stick to the ones with numbers by them. On the top half of this amendment, on lines 1.3 and 1.4, the committee needed to back into the right equalizing factor for the operating capital levy share. As members know, this committee is assigned an aid target by the Ways and Means Committee that's a part of the budget resolution. The Education Finance Committee also operates under an informal levy target where there should be no change from baseline levies. And because of some of the other movement in the bill, primarily the repeal of the voluntary pre-kindergarten, levies are going down compared to baseline in some areas, and so the adjustment that's been used for any of these kinds of increases or decreases in levy over the last several years has been the operating capital levy. So the lines 1.3 and 1.4 essentially keep the statewide total levy the same. A relatively small amount of levy under this bill is moving about $2.3 million statewide per year out of about $2.6 billion of levy. So relatively small amount moving. And these changes on 1.3 and 1.4 balance that out by changing the operating capital levy.
Ms. Pera. Madam Chair, members, the changes that you see to page 21, those are on lines 12 to 17 of the first page of the amendment. Those make changes. First, it deletes Section 8. Section 8 amended Statute Section 120B12 Subdivision 3 and required intervention to continue after grade 3 if a student was not reading at grade level. The remaining changes to page 21, amended section 9 of the bill, relating to dyslexia and literacy specialists, and deleted the words "and specialist" from the title. The duties of the specialists remain the same. There are a couple of changes. It deletes the word "certified psychometrist" from the definition of the specialist, and it also substitutes where it says "program guidelines" in the purpose section. There, it changes it to "implementation guidance and recommendations for the commissioner." There are also changes on page 28 of the bill. Adding language that appeared in the policy bill. You'll see it adds a section 14, amending statute section 120B31, the rollout sites and report. And again, this appeared in the education policy omnibus bill. It relates to data disaggregation. Turning then to page 3 of the A47 amendment, the changes on line 3.4 and 3.8, those change the effective dates of two sections already in the bill relating again to data disaggregation. There's also a change on line 3.5, substituting where it says state demographers report. It'll say American Community Survey, and that's the census.
Madam Chair, members, starting on line 3.11 of the amendment, the change on 3.11, the Representative Lee's provision was intended to be effective for one additional year for the early middle college program for the students 21 to 22. This language clarifies that. On line 3.12 on the civic education grant, the name of the organization that was an organization formerly known as Kids Voting St. Paul has changed to Minnesota Civic Youth. The next several dollar amounts and some of those on the first page as well really are just tying out to Ms. Adrian's spreadsheet. Occasionally as we're going through iterations, we're trying to make sure everything lines up. These dollar amounts essentially are reflective of what's on the spreadsheet, and there's no policy changes that have caused these dollar amounts to change. On line 318, this is the mental health plans for the intermediate school districts and the service cooperatives. The author of those amendments had intended to ensure that the service cooperative reference was just the Southwest West Central Service Cooperative. And that's what line 318 clarifies. 319, Madam Chair, just uses a better word in our opinion to describe what's happening there. Ms. Adrians may want to speak to the next couple of changes. The fiscal note for the Board of Teaching changes in House File 140 came out. And as that did, it affected how this bill is tracking the teacher licensure money to both the Board of Teaching and its potential successor and the Minnesota Department of Education.
Ms. Adrians. Madam Chair and members, this is just as Mr. Strom said. So we received the fiscal note, and it's removing the funds that were attached to the employees under the Department of Education, and we're putting that under the Board of Teaching. So it's just taking the funding that from one agency and putting it into the other.
Thank you, Ms. A. Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The next change you'll see is to page 127. It deletes lines 4 to 6. This is the appropriation section for the Department of Education. The amount is unchanged. What this change does is it takes that paragraph, that clause 1, and breaks it out into then 3 separate clauses to kind of better delineate what that is, and it adds some language explaining what the language arts specialist will do, and it states that it will provide support to districts to implement the language arts standards that Minnesota already has.
Okay. Thank you. And then
Madam Chair, the remainder of the appropriations are to the Board of Teaching, and as Ms. Adrians explained, the fiscal note is putting more of the additional costs there and less on the department. So those are the changes through the end of 4.3.
Thank you, all three of you. Any questions on the author's amendment A47? Representative Teason.
Thank you. Can someone explain the change on line 1.12, the deletion of that section?
Ms. Barron.
Madam Chair, Representative Teason, just give me one second.
Well, I'm going to give you the layman's legislator explanation.
Yes, that's
good.
Thanks.
So in working with the sort of advocates on the dyslexia language, they wanted us to pull or try to mirror the Senate language, which they were happy with. And so in pulling that, we inadvertently pulled from another section of Senate policy language that was not related to this specifically. So we took that back out. It was inadvertently included in the bill, and so we're removing that. So again, the changes that follow 1.12, so starting on line 1.13, again, are specifically related to the dyslexia language. The previous section, again, was borrowed from Senate language that was unrelated to this specific provision. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a cost to that Section 8?
I don't believe so, but Ms. Farah?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, there's no cost that I'm that we're aware of.
Okay, and so, Madam Chair, so just if I understand that section, what that section was doing was just continuing reading intervention after grade 3 for kids that aren't at grade level. I just don't know why we wouldn't want to do that.
Representative Thiessen, well, the schools already do reading intervention for children not reading at grade level. I think there were concerns about, I guess, more this explicit statement in statute. I understand that the department also had concerns about it. So, again, because it was unrelated to the changes we were trying to make to mirror the dyslexia language, we took it out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the A47 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Amendment is adopted. All right. Let's see. All right, members. So next, I'll call on. I think it's Representative Erickson is offering the A32 amendment.
Madam Chair, I offer the A32.
All right. Representative Erickson, to your amendment.
Madam Chair and members, the A32 makes the accountability system for the state for ESSA the world's best workforce. And in this amendment, as you see on lines 1.14 to 1.22, these are basically elements of the world's best workforce that now would become ours, part of our state ESSA plan.
All right. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any questions on the A32 amendment?
And Madam Chair, just for verification, we have one accountability system.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Debney?
Madam Chair, I'm interested in the amendment. I think this is coming. This is a complex question that's coming at us without my feeling sufficient background. Would this be one where you'd be willing to let the department explain ESSA and accountability systems and how this fits into their plan? I believe they've already had to submit their plan. No, not yet, but they're developing it, and I'd just like to understand how this all fits. Is that a fair request?
Yes, if Mr. Uni or whoever's here from the department wants to come down.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Dabney, thank you for the question. We, in our creation of the ESSA state plan, have engaged with hundreds of stakeholder groups across the state and across the spectrum of teachers, administrators, parents, students, other interested parties. And we feel that the creation of the state plan should be guided by our consultation process, which the federal government has, and the ESSA law has asked us to do. This would be an insertion into our state plan that hasn't necessarily gone through the full discussion process with our stakeholders as well as at the department. I think we want to take a larger look at what this is requiring and see if these are components that we can discuss and wrap in rather than being mandated to necessarily do it. So without having our experts take a detailed look at it, I can't speak to the exact impact, but I would say from a procedural level, we would ask the legislature to continue to let us do the consultation process that we've been engaging in to create the ESSA state plan, and we're more than happy to take a look at this and see how these components can be wrapped in. However, I know that for our state plan process, we have obviously been talking about how our world's best workforce reflects our accountability system and how that should be involved in our state plan to the federal government. So I know we're speaking about those components. These specifically, in terms of how this is spelled out, I think we need to take a stronger look at this, but I can assure you that our world's best workforce plan is going to be under our world's best workforce statute is undergirding a lot of our work in our SSA plan.
Thank you, Mr. Ennie. Representative Mariani or Chief Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ennie, and excuse me, I would have preferred we would have had a longer conversation in policy committee on this. I think there may be an element of complexity here. I'm not necessarily averse to this, Representative Erickson. I just have all of a few seconds to absorb it. I'm just wondering, Mr. Ennie, and I think you're also trying to catch up with it as well, is there anything in this amendment that potentially poses any issues relative to the process by which the department would be submitting its plan to USDOE? I think what I'm wrestling with is world's best workforce, of course, is our state accountability system, and I think there's good, strong bipartisan support for that. Is there anything here that indicates that because we're talking about the state's accountability system, we're going to have to come back and vet it through our legislative process in terms of submitting the plan to the federal government? And you may not know, but I'm just looking to make sure we're not doing unintentional harm here in terms of the timing of the department's submission of the plan.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, in this language, I don't see the submission to the legislature, but I believe in the bill itself there is a provision that requires the department to send in its ESSA plan, submit its ESSA plan to the legislature before we submit it to the federal government, and then to get legislative approval before we implement it. I think that could have grave consequences for our timelines in terms of how we implement it. If we get approval from the Department of Education and then the legislature has to approve it, which may incur changes to our state plan or concerns about our state plan, that could also have an impact on the timeline in which we are expected by the federal government to implement the law, which would have an impact on the funding flows that we have out to our title schools as well as the department. So I believe that having the legislature in the approval process of our state plans could have some serious unintended complications or implications for our funding flows as well as the timeline of how we get these plans out the door and to our schools.
Representative Mariani.
And Madam Chair, and there are to some degree two distinct issues there, right? On the other hand, I would hope that were this amendment to go on, that it doesn't become the argument for that present language in the bill that requires an approval back here in the legislature. Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I'm just wondering, again, I'm not adverse to this. I just don't quite know what the impact of it. And I'm wondering if this amendment were to go on, what your position would be relative to working with the department and myself and others to make sure we're not creating some unintentional harm, or any harm, for that matter, by this language.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani and Mr. Ennie. I think it's very important that we realize that in 2013, the world's best workforce became law. And in addition to that, an MMR system is designed. And the complications that those two cause for state accountability is not necessary when we have the world's best workforce. And what I've delineated in this amendment is every part of the world's best workforce. So let's use one standard, a piece of legislation that's already been enacted, the world's best workforce, as our the basis for our plan, and build off that so that districts are not doing both the world's best workforce and then trying to comply to another system, because I'm afraid that's what it could evolve into. So this is simple, it is direct, and I hope that you would support it, and yes, we'll continue to work with the department.
Thank you. Mr. Ennie?
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, So I just want to reiterate the work we've been doing, not only on what the components of engagement with community and parents look like, but also not only with the all stakeholders, hundreds of stakeholders, but as well as with our experts, our testing experts, and our psychometrists, and our other experts around testing and quality measures.
Mr. Ernie, I have to suspend. They're voting in tax committee, so for members who wish to go up to vote. Sorry, it's a timer thing. I'm sorry, Mr. Ernie. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I've been around long enough to know that this is how it kind of goes during this time of session. I would strongly caution the committee to start mandating specific measures that we have to do without consultation with the experts that we have been engaging with for over a year on what our state plan needs to look like and what our measures of quality need to look like. Additionally, you know, I'm getting some messages that some of this stuff, some of the items or components in here we don't currently measure, so we need to take a look at what systems we would need to build out or what alternatives we could have that are doable in the time frame within which we're working. So I would urge extreme caution in adopting a set amount of measures in state law about what we need to collect in our state ESSA plan when it doesn't go through the consultation process that we've been engaged with. We've made a commitment and a promise to the people that we're working with that we're going to be open and transparent about how we're creating this state plan, and we do believe that this could kind of jeopardize the integrity of that process.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these stakeholder groups that you're talking about, are they open to the public? Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes, they are.
So public can come in and listen to them, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes.
And your, Mr. Madam Chair, Thiessen. The consultations with your experts, are those open to the public?
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes.
So when you consult with your experts, you call your expert on the phone to talk with your psychometrist, the public can come and listen to that.
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we don't consult with our experts who are external stakeholder groups that come in over the phone. We have public committee meetings at the department.
Okay. And Madam Chair, what are these, who are the experts that are invited to these stakeholder group meetings? Or who are the stakeholders invited to these group meetings?
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, for all of our state ESSA plan, these would include many of the members who are here today representing the school groups, the teachers.
Not members.
And the advocates who are around, are engaged with our, or who represent our administrators, our teachers, our school districts, as well as testing experts, other experts in the school area from specific school districts, from our universities, as well as community members representing the specific demographic groups from around the state. We've engaged in technical committees that look at technical aspects like testing, as well as engaged with parents and teachers and other stakeholders in areas about what does a turnaround effort at a school look like. What does a well-rounded education look like? I'm more than happy to provide a full comprehensive list of the groups that we've worked with, as well as the committees that we've engaged with and focus groups that we've conducted to the committee.
Madam Chair, how are those meetings advertised to the public?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we have sent out, we've advertised on our website, we've sent out messages through our emails to our specific groups that we have contacts with on a regular basis. We've done personal outreach to the groups on a consistent basis, from the executive committee down to hiring a community liaison whose specific job is to do community outreach with all of these groups on a consistent basis. A lot of the members that who have attended on a consistent basis have had relationships with the department for ongoing years. More of the newer members that we're bringing into the fold have come under specific outreach from many members, including myself, to, again, the community outreach liaison that we've brought on.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say these groups, who are you talking about?
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. Again, I can provide a full list, but in terms of groups, I can talk about the representative groups of our communities of color and American Indian communities, including Cal, the councils, the school district representative groups like AMSD, MERA, C, our administrator groups like MASA, our teacher groups like Admin, and a range of other representative groups. And again, I don't have them off the top of my head. I'm more than happy to provide them to the committee before even committee ends today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, no, I appreciate that, and you know, I guess I would say I don't think that bringing back the plan to the legislature to approve it back is in the way in the timeline is the right thing. But I just really don't know why the department would oppose the legislature having some input and actually saying what should be in that ESSA plan, and especially if it's based off the world's best workforce. And nothing in this amendment seems to me to be things that shouldn't be considered as part of that plan. So all the groups and all the folks in this room do great work, but they are also the people that are always in this room, right? And we need to, it seems to me, we need to do better than just listening to the so-called groups that are always in this room. And that's one of our jobs as a legislature, is to listen to other people. And so I don't know why, I can see why the department would oppose the requiring the plan to come back if that gets in the way of opposing it, but to come up then oppose the legislature have any input in this plan seems to me to be the wrong direction to be going.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Couldn't have said it better myself. I must say I agree with your comments wholeheartedly. Other discussion? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ooney, for talking about, it sounds like a very exhaustive process. You've been very inclusive and collaborative and very open, and I commend you for that. So, and you've been working on this for a year, so when do you think that it will be done?
Mr. Ooney.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, the original plan was to submit, or our original idea was to submit this spring. Obviously, with the new incoming administration, we've had some pushback with timelines. Our plan now is to submit in the allowable time frame in September. I believe there is a couple months that the Department of U.S. DOE has to do a turnaround, and we'll get it back in the end of the year or the beginning of the following year. Whether they have any changes to it or request a change, I'm not sure. But our state plan needs, our timeline is to have it wrapped up and submitted to the feds in September.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Mariani.
Chair, at this point, I would counsel some caution on our part. I think we're here for Representative Erickson, and she's open to continue to work with myself and others in the department, and so that gives me some comfort about moving forward with this. I do have to say, I do have to remind folks that, you know, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars that come into the state from the federal government through the ESSA process. And so when we consider these kind of amendments, we have to keep that in mind. We'll have another debate about the legislature report process. So I would, with some discomfort, say, you know, we could do this amendment at this point, but I do want to be a voice of caution here. You all heard Mr. Rooney talk about how some of these indicators here we don't currently measure, and that's what the ESSA plan is about. You know, it's about pulling together, it's about accountability system that's based on measuring outcomes and then having high stakes consequences to the state and some prescriptions about how we would move forward with the use of federal funds. So I just want to caution that we really know what the heck we're doing when we do amendments like this. And because we haven't had the kind of time to have this conversation, I would submit most of us, including me, do not know what this means relative to each and every one of these indicators here. So in the spirit, you know, on the record of moving, of Representative Erickson working with several folks to make sure we're not doing any harm, I would hesitantly I guess abstain from voting on this issue, but I do want to be a word of caution for us here today.
Thank you. Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, I would just like to reemphasize just a few points. The commissioner has consistently said that our federal plan for ESSA should be very closely aligned with our world's best workforce. So that is, I want to provide some assurances that the department and the governor strongly believe in the world's best workforce plan that was passed in 2013. You've seen a lot of the work that we've done. We believe it's working. It's going to continue to work, and that's what should be undergirding our federal accountability system. I do want to say, in terms of outreach, we've also been in communication with the committees going forward. I know there's new membership now, but in the past year, we have been in communication with the committees in terms of what our efforts have been ongoing and doing presentations. I just do want to say that we want to be very careful about these measures, and the department would like some time to have our people who have been working on our world's best workforce system, as well as working on our asset plan, have time to digest these and see how they could work. And if the legislature does feel very strongly about going forward with this, that the department be included in discussions in terms of making sure that we get these components correct.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And I assure you that we will continue discussing this and being open to dialogue with the department. But again, I think Representative Erickson's amendment and comments made by other committee members, Representative Thiessen and others, indicate, you know, this is a real area where I think the legislature has legitimate interest in knowing that the plan is going to align as closely as possible with world's best workforce, something that the schools have invested massive time and effort and dollars into creating. And if there's one thing I hear over and over again from school districts is to, you know, can we be consistent and not change our accountability measures and standards from year to year, or from whatever the latest new change is, either whether it be federal or state law. They want some manner of consistency to continue their plans, and I think this maybe gives them some measure of assurance that that's where this is headed. But again, I understand as well the need to continue dialogue with the department about particular issues or tweaks as this goes along, and so you have my personal commitment to that as well. Other comments or discussion? All right. With that, I will renew Representative Erickson's motion to adopt the A32 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Thiessen, you have the A3 amendment, I believe.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, this amendment, and actually Representative Fenton has a bill on this as well, that might be a little bit different than this one, but essentially moving in the same direction. This has to do with lead in drinking water. You know, we all know the story of what happened in Flint, Michigan, and a lot of which arose, well, some of it people knew about, and that was the worst part of it, but some of which arose because at least the people in Flint didn't know about it. You know, the fact is Minnesota does not right now require school districts to test for lead in the drinking water in schools. And we all know, and have had testimony in this committee in the past, at least, and certainly in Health and Human Services, about the impact of lead on learning and on brain development. And if we really want to, you know, move forward, we need to, on making sure all of our kids are having a chance to learn effectively, we do need to take a much broader public health look at a lot of these things. So what the amendment does is it requires the creation of a model plan, but mainly that school boards and charter schools adopt a plan to accurately and efficiently test for the presence of lead in their school buildings. So it would be the first time we'd actually require a plan to test for lead, and that they do the testing a couple years in a row in 18 and 19, and then every five years thereafter, and that they include improvements of, if they find a problem, that they include that in their 10-year facilities plan, how they're going to fix that, and that they actually let the public know what's going on, so parents can make informed choices. Right now, I think the lead testing level is at 20 parts per billion. That's the Safe Schools level at the EPA. The American Academy of Pediatrics said that school water fountains shouldn't exceed 1 part per billion. You know, so there's a difference between 20 and 1, and maybe there's some work that needs, that the school districts that they're urging, their own control could do. But we have have school districts in this state that are tested at 942 parts per billion. In the Burnsville, Egan, Savage School District, there was a drinking Teflon test in 2013 that had 942 parts per billion. It's one of the highest contaminant levels on record in the state. And so we know that this is a serious issue, and we don't want to be in a situation, as far as I'm concerned, where people come back to us 5, 6, 7 years from now and say, look, we have this problem with lead in our schools, and it's having a public health impact on our kids, and we didn't do anything about it. I don't believe there's actually a cost to this bill, so I don't know why we, I mean, there could be a cost to the school districts to come up with a plan, and I would acknowledge that. But this seems like a fundamental public health and education level that, and it's a very low bar for us just to actually test and find out what the lead levels are in our school districts' drinking water. So with that, I just ask people to vote for it.
Thank you, Representative Houston. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, obviously we all care if there's lead in our, particularly in our schools. I mean, there's no question about that. But I was just curious, you know, you talked about there may be a cost to the schools, and if you had any numbers on what that would look like. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Thiessen. Thanks. Well, the department has to come up with a model plan. The Department of Health and Education come up with a model plan, and the school district could just adopt that. So that part should be fairly straightforward if they just want to adopt that. The testing actually doesn't cost that much, and there's some schools that are already doing this testing. I know my own school district in Minneapolis is doing this testing. Obviously, Burnsville, Egan, and Savage did this testing because they found out. I don't know if they've done anything about it. So there would be a cost. I just don't think it's that significant a cost to do lead testing, though, frankly. I mean, you know, it's in the tens. I shouldn't speak, but.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, so I did reach out to Burnsville School District, and I found out that they were paying $30,000 per building for the testing. And my concern is that while that was definitely important for them to do that, my concern is mandating it for every school may have an impact on people's budgets, as well as we know these facility plans do require a 10-year plan, and they might be 7 years into it, and whether or not that they've planned for this type of testing, it's hard to say. So I guess that would be my concern. When I first heard this bill being introduced, I did reach out to representatives from some of the school districts, and they were concerned. So, I mean, I think that we need to have a little bit more conversation about this bill before we start amending it and requiring, you know, basically putting the mandates on schools before we even know really what it's going to cost or what it's going to look like. And, you know, cities themselves, like Flint, was a travesty, but cities are responsible for making sure their drinking water starts out safe, and I think that Minnesota has done a good job of making sure that the testing that's done at the city level so that they know at least they're starting out with good city water, but there's I just think there needs to be more work on this. Thank you.
Representative Norness.
Madam Chair, I was just thinking that it seems to me the Department of Health and our municipal water systems would already be doing this, I would hope. And I don't know that for a fact, but I would hope that they make sure the water is safe, and they do mandate other things that these water systems are able to assure us. Spend millions of dollars to do that, so I would hope that lead would be one of the things they test for, but I don't know. So I don't know if this is necessary at this point. So.
Thank you. I wish we had the opportunity to hear this bill or another bill in the committee on this, because, you know, certainly it's a topic that's come up, and there's been some investigative reporting in that around it, certainly a media eye-catcher, and something that I think that's of concern to people. I think there probably are some costs here to school districts that are not quantified. But a Representative Thiessen, I'm prepared to take the amendment, but I would say that as this moves into conference committee, I hope certainly you'd be amenable as we have opportunities to talk with the school associations and that to figure out maybe timelines and more specifics around this that helps them deal with, again, unplanned costs around what really is a pretty substantial mandate without supporting information or opportunity to review. All right. Yeah, I know. I have people poised who want to testify on this, and I'm trying to hold them at bay for the moment. I hope you were hearing what I was saying. Okay. All right. Any other comments?
Absolutely to your comments.
Thank you. All right. So with the understanding that this is probably going to continue to have discussion throughout the process as we move into conference and discussion, we have everyone on record agreeing to work on this. But in the spirit of the sort of essence and intent of the amendment, Representative Thiessen moves his motion to adopt the A3 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Right. A3 amendment is adopted. I think you have the next one too, Representative Thiessen, A4.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So this, we heard earlier in this session some, probably among the most powerful and compelling testimony I thought of the session about mental health, about mental health issues, and particularly as it relates to the intermediate school districts and some folks, some kids in our schools that are in primarily level four schools, special ed kids that have serious mental health problems, and about a project that is being pulled together to try to get more resources to those schools to help those kids. And it's the money right now is going to certain intermediate school districts, as well as, I guess, one in Southwest Minnesota, Service Co-op, thank you. And so what this amendment does is, in Minneapolis, there is a school called the Harrison Education Center, which is the same school, same kind of school as all of those. It is a level four school. I visited it earlier this year. The students there have the same needs and are facing the same challenges as are the teachers and others, as the students and teachers in the schools getting this money. So all this would add in the Harrison Education Center to be eligible for the money that's being appropriated, just like these other intermediate school districts and the ones Service Co-op. There's no difference I can see between the ones that are qualifying now and Harrison. So I would just ask that Harrison also be included to be able to compete for that money.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Well, unfortunately I have to oppose your amendment, and it's not that there aren't great needs probably at Harrison, and there are a number of school districts that have level four schools or provisions for level four students within them. But the proposal that I brought forward and how it was crafted was probably more than a year of work by the intermediates to try to develop a plan for how these mental health professionals, if they were to receive the grants and as we move forward, how they'd be embedded in their programming, how they're going to measure the effectiveness. So it really is more of a pilot to see if this is a model for how we could change the current structure of facilities for level four students. And it's my understanding that Harrison wasn't involved in those meetings and those plans. I'm not sure if they understand sort of the pilot and how it's structured to work. So while I understand why you would want to advocate for them, I just think I don't think we're there yet in terms of the opportunity to roll that out to other schools. I certainly have high hopes for, this pilot and the money that's provided for it in the bill we're considering today. I think it is perhaps the solution to addressing really the combining of education and mental health services in one location for students who need it. But I don't think we're ready to be able to roll it out to all level four schools at this time. So unfortunately, that's the reason for opposing your amendment, but not the intent of what you're trying to do.
And Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And I would just hope that as this pilot goes forward, that the folks who are doing it would reach out to schools like Harrison to so that we can share some of that learning and also maybe inform each other. But I'll withdraw the amendment, Madam Chair. But I think it's a fabulous program, but I just hope that we can... I hope it becomes a fabulous program, I guess.
Yes.
But I hope that the benefits of it can be spread more broadly.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. I would agree. In fact, I would say publicly, I think it would be an expectation of the folks working on this pilot and the intermediates to be sharing sort of the work that they're doing and the results they're getting as a way to inform, again, best practices for other schools and as they do that, if I'm in a position to continue advocating for the funding to roll this out to the rest of those level four providers, I will absolutely do that. So thank you. I appreciate the discussion. And Representative Thiessen withdraws the A4, is that right? Mm-hmm. A4 amendment?
Correct.
All right. All right. A12 amendment, Representative Thiessen.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, first of all, I want to thank Representative Erickson, who gave a hearing in her committee on basically kind of the disparity in referrals based on, particularly based on race, to special ed and particularly to EBD. And she was kind enough to put in her bill some language related to that, which is in... section, well, on page 71, section 1, can't remember what article, the special ed article. We since then have been working with a number of stakeholders to kind of focus it in on where the issue really is. So in the language in the bill right now basically has training for cultural competency for paraprofessionals in special ed. Language that school districts have to make that cultural competency training available to other teachers. And as we've explored this further, it seems like the first step in that direction, maybe before we kind of go as broad as that, is to be more data-driven. So what the amendment would actually do, and just so people that aren't on policy, you know, we have a fairly significant disparity. It depends kind of where you are, but most often African-Americans and African-American boys being referred to EBD special ed than the rest of the population. It's also true of American Indians and to a lesser extent some other groups. And you know, one of the things we see, especially when they go to some of these high-level special ed situations where the disparity increases, so level four it gets even higher, you know, a lot of times that's kind of it leads to a lack of success and opportunity. And it's part of the reason, I think, for, well, a number of outcomes we have in our society, including some of our academic disparities. So what this amendment would do is very data-driven. So at the site level, so at the school level, it would require the school twice a year, the teachers and the administrators, to sit down and look at their data about referrals to special education. And if they see these disparities, to come up with a plan either to address it or to understand why they're there. Sometimes they're there for good reasons and people and kids actually need the services. But it's just to be more mindful of that. And then it would also require that if there's if they see certain teachers referring at much higher levels than their colleagues, and a lot of these times, you know, you'll have a kid that's in three classes or a bunch of kids in three classes, and there's one teacher that is referring disproportionately where their colleagues aren't. We should pay attention to that. And so it would just require some cultural competency training for teachers that are over-referring. And we worked with a number of, again, stakeholder groups to come up with this language. I think it's pretty targeted. It will allow us to actually make a difference here. I think this was a real solution to this challenge, and I would hope that people could support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Other discussion to the amendment? And Representative Erickson, I know that you did work on this in the policy committee, and that it is a component of your policy bill, the training in that. I just wondered if you had any particular perspective or wanted to share the policy, just reminding members, I guess, from the policy bill what was provided for.
Madam Chair and members, in regard to this amendment, it's not that this information isn't important, but this is a mandate on teachers who I think would review data anyway. So I don't think we need to be telling them that at least twice a year they've got to review the data, because then they are going to be involved in a reconstruction of much of what it is they already have in the IEP. I think where we are in the policy bill right now is a good first step, and we should stay there with the training, the cultural competency understanding, and let this data review continue at a local level rather than mandating it from the state level. And it's not that it isn't important data to review, but I think it's a bit much right now. So I think it's best to stay with the language we have presently.
Thank you, Madam Chair Erickson. I think Representative Thiessen, I've thought about this a lot, and I appreciate you sharing with me the amendment before you filed it. And unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to talk because I got home so late last night. But I guess I do have a bit of a concern, one with, you know, a very prescriptive number of times to review the data. We know that the schools have to review their data, and that's part of special ed, and I'm wondering if this is going to add to increased paperwork and as they document that, and something we're trying to get away from. And the other concern I might have is, you know, if we're specifically kind of identifying teachers because of referring a disproportionate number, if teachers are going to be worried about being sort of flagged or pegged, and then they won't be referring students who maybe should be evaluated. I guess I can see the intent of what you're trying to go here, but I guess I'm a little bit worried about this sort of backfiring a little bit on in terms of teachers having a concern of being sort of identified in that way. We certainly want them to have the training. I think the PBIS, Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports training, is very good from all the information I've received. I know a number of schools have gone through the efforts of employing it. We've provided grants to schools in the past. But I guess I'm a little bit hesitant about going this additional step in prescribing very specifically how the schools implement this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I don't think that there's going to be additional paperwork. Certainly, there's no additional reporting required that's explicitly in the provision. We have talked with the groups that I disparaged just earlier about this, and they don't seem to have any problems with kind of the reporting part of it. Madam Chair, and I also have to say, you know, and we talk about this a lot, but, you know, the potential that we might hurt a teacher's feelings, I don't think should be a reason that we don't take steps to actually solve what is a problem in our schools, and this is a very real problem in our schools. And so I don't necessarily, I mean, you know, there, you know, people say all the time we shouldn't be focused on the adults, we should be focused on the kids. And I think we should be focused on the kids. But, Madam Chair, one thing I'd like to do maybe as in light of your comments is if I could divide the amendment between 1.14 and 1.15. So what that would do would just be the requirement that the school district actually at the site level, this is not district reviewing its data, which I think does happen, but at the school site level reviewing its data. That seems to me to be at least, so I'd like if we could divide the amendments that way.
Okay, so I think that the amendment does appear to be divisible. So Representative Thiessen has moved to divide the amendment, so lines 1.1 to 1.14 would be the first portion. Any comments to sections, or sections 1, subdivision 1, and subdivision 2?
And Madam Chair, if I might?
Yes.
I'd also, as part of that, just like to delete line 1.3 in the first section, too. So it would actually keep the training component for paraprofessionals and for students, the part that was in Representative Erickson's bill.
All right, so Representative Thiessen strikes line 1.3 from the amendment. You know, Representative Thiessen, I think I just have concerns about this. I have concerns about the specifics of the reporting or the review process and that. So I appreciate your effort to try to mitigate concerns about the specific identification of teachers. But I'm just not ready to accept this amendment. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to oppose it. Other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A12 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Amendment does not prevail.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, I guess I need to withdraw the other half of the amendment then, right?
Yes. So now on the... That's true, we didn't divide it. So we... I would move to reconsider the vote on the A12 amendment, having voted on the prevailing side. So the A12 amendment is back before us as proposed by Representative Thiessen. Line 1.3 has been deleted, and so the question now is on the first portion of the amendment, lines 1.14 through 1.4 through 1.14, correct. All right, so any further discussion? All right. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to speak to this first portion of the amendment. And, you know, I agree with Representative Thiessen on just really the number of kids of color, especially who are going into special education classes, in no way to track or monitor that process, or know why, or whether or not it is because maybe there's a cultural piece there or disconnect between teachers and pupils. And so, and then I hear you also state that, you know, you're not ready to just commit to the number of times that they need to look back and see, you know, and take a look at the number of kids who are in these ELL programs, or special education programs, should I say. So I was, you know, hoping that you could, you know, if two times is too much, you know, do a verbal amendment and say at least once during a school year to take a look back and see, you know, where they are, the number of kids that they are engaging, or to put, you know, what is the emotional behavior evaluations, why, and how they can move to a place where they are moving kids into the mainstream classrooms. And so, you know, that's my piece. If we can do an oral amendment, and maybe that's more doable, but to not look back and get a better understanding about why kids have been placed in or been labeled themselves is a disregard for looking at all the kids in a very holistic, whole place and moving kids forward to be successful. So my hope is that we can look at a way and a pathway that we can at least allow schools to begin to see you know, what's going on within that school building with every child.
All right. Representative Moran, I appreciate your comments and the spirit in which you are moving this. Here's what I'm going to propose. If in subdivision one, we could change two times to at least once each school year, and in subdivision two, again, make that at least once. So everywhere it says two times, it'll be once. And if we can change must to are encouraged, so at least once each school year, a school district is encouraged to review. So it would be encouraged to would replace must. If you're amenable to that, Representative Thiessen and Representative Moran, I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Sure.
Yes?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask staff to repeat that back so everyone is clear. And again, the amendment is still divided, so we're talking about changes to the upper section. So I'm going to repeat. So, yes, we're still striking line 1.3. So 1.3, which references page 71, delete section 1 and insert that's deleted. Ms. Pera.
Madam Chair, the amendment would then, the part that is stricken is in line 1.25, we would delete, which says two times, and insert once. On line 1.6, delete must, and insert is encouraged to. And on line 1.11, delete two times, and insert once.
And
is must also delete? Okay. Delete must and insert is encouraged to.
Okay. So is everyone clear on the changes? Seeing not? Okay. So with those changes incorporated into the amendment, I would... Then all in favor of the A-12 amendment, the first portion, as orally amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right?
I'll withdraw the second part.
And the second portion is withdrawn. All right?
Thank
you. So we are completed with A-12. Thank you, Representative Thiessen and Moran, for your helpful comments. All right.
That was a good job.
All right, so I just have these kind of on a sheet listing all the amendments. They're in no particular order. I have the A17-0284 amendment. Representative Mariani, is that yours?
That's
all right. Representative Mariani, if you'd like to speak to your amendment. Members, again, the A17-0284.
Madam Chair, I would so move the amendment. Excuse me. It's actually a pretty simple amendment. There's effectively what it does. It shifts $3 million from the teacher shortage loan forgiveness. Is it $3 or $4 million? I want to make sure I've got that right. It is three. So it shifts $3 million from the teacher shortage loan forgiveness in the present bill, which is at $4 million dollars. To fund grants for student teachers in shortage areas at $1.5 million per year. We heard a little bit about this at the end of yesterday's testimony, so if you were here, you may have caught that, and that was from a representative from the Statewide Teachers of Color American Indian Teachers Coalition. Dr. Paul Spies presented on behalf of that group. I've done quite a bit of work, Madam Chair, with that group over the last year. It's a group that represents a statewide presence for teachers of color, American Indian teachers from across the state that have that have come together to help push us, as well as to help push our current delivery systems to really step it up in terms of increasing the number of increasing the diversity of our teaching force in the state of Minnesota. As you all have heard repeatedly, we're at about 4% of our entire teaching corps in the state. And one of the things that, and by the way, Madam Chair, I was out in Oregon earlier this year. I missed a few days. I apologize. Looking at their teacher of color, American Indian teacher effort, and my hope is to be able to come back next year with some strong policy recommendations based on what we're learning from that state. It's a state that mirrors us in many ways in terms of our diversity. They're a smaller state, though, in terms of demographics, and yet their teacher of color presence in their entire teacher license workforce is almost three times as large as ours. They didn't get there by mistake or by accident. They got there through a very intentional process. My hope is to be able to lay that forward for us in the coming year. However, what Dr. Spies said yesterday, I thought is worth repeating in regards to this amendment. It's going to take the production of 600 teachers in 1 year if we're going to move from 4% to 5%. We heard testimony from one of the Q programs that had licensed 24 or had properly prepared 24 candidates in the last biennium. Who are from those communities, you know, at that rate, Madam Chair, you know, we'll need another 24 programs just to get to the 600 number, which just gets us to 5% of the teaching corps in the state as our student population continues to diversify. And as you all know, we're about 30% students of color, American Indian students right now. 20 years ago, we were less than 10%. So there really is an urgency, I think, for us to be able to look at every tool available for us. And what this amendment does, and I'm working within the numbers, I mean, frankly, I think we ought to be making much bigger investments, but trying to stay within the numbers here so we have a revenue-neutral amendment. What this does is it redirects some of those dollars to immediate work. There's an immediacy in terms of student teaching. It's one of the big barriers to be able to get through that period of time with minimal or no income coming in is a huge barrier for diversifying our teaching corps. And so the spirit and the intent of this proposal is to you know, still keep the loan forgiveness piece, which is a later investment, if you will, in terms of immediate impact and the budget of a family, and shift some of those dollars for some immediate impact so that it could be a more powerful inducement to get things done right now. And having said all that, we're still barely going to move the needle in the state. But I do believe this will help a bit, and I would encourage your support for the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to speak on behalf of this bill, this amendment. And want to ditto everything that Representative Mariani just spoke about. You know, but first I would like to say to you and to the members that I want to thank you for including diversity as a shortage area. I think that was a good move and a needed move, so thank you for that. So, you know, I've had the opportunity to, you know, try to talk with teachers, those who have aspirations to be teachers, about, you know, what is the barriers? What do they consider the number one barrier to becoming a teacher? And many, over and over again, I hear that it is the student teaching part, that is the barrier, the biggest barrier, because it's an unpaid, it's for 3 months, 12 weeks of unpaid, you know, work. And I had an opportunity to hear a story from a young woman who was a mother who decided to go back to school to become a teacher, and hardworking woman who decided that, you know, it was really important for her to get into the school system and did all the things right, graduated, did well in school, and went into her student teaching piece and was excited about it and did well and got into the eighth week of the student teacher, where she had to go to her supervisor and say, you know, I can't do this. I just can't afford to continue on to do the student teaching and do my duties as a mother take care of my household. And so it is truly, truly a barrier for many of for many individuals becoming teachers. And I want you to know that, you know, pulling $3 million to really support, you know, student teachers where they can have their financial needs taken care of, where they can pay for tuition, their living expenses during the 3 months. It's 3 months full-time unpaid experience that is required for licensure. And so it's just really asking us to consider that and think about how we can really create a pathway for more teachers to come, to more individuals to become teachers. And to be able to do that and do it efficiently by having those needs taken care of. And, you know, and this is not just about teachers of color. This is for licensure areas where there's a shortage around the licensure, the geographic area, and then also for racial ethnic groups. And it's a statewide initiative that this is not an urban issue or urban concern. It is a statewide concern for many who wants to be a part of the teaching profession but are limited in that three-month experience of unpaid experience that is required of them. So my hope is that you can also consider and support Representative Mariani amendment as stated.
All right, thank you. Other comments? Well, you know, I appreciate what you're offering, and Representative Mariani, and I have talked with Dr. Spies and others, and, you know, I'm amenable to looking as we move through the process for funds to try to do this, but I really and am reticent to take money out of our loan forgiveness for this. In the hopes that we may have additional resources to work on this as we move again into conference on that. So I am going to respectfully oppose your amendment at this time. Other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A17-0284 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Amendment is not adopted. Representative Murphy, do you have the A27? All right, the A27 amendment. Representative Murphy, to your amendment.
Madam Chair,
Representative Murphy,
committee. I move adoption of the H-27 amendment with some codicils in that I'm not thrilled to death where the money is coming from. Like several of the other amendments that have passed tonight, we just have to talk about full service community schools because we've come so far. And I think that's probably why we didn't have money for them yesterday and why the people that testified yesterday for their program that got in the bill were lauding the bill because theirs got in. But because theirs got in, they were for reasonable amounts at smaller levels than what full-service community schools will take to get it in this bill this year. But I have to review where we're at with full-service community schools. We have a waiting list of applicants that want to begin. They want to begin because they know that full-service community schools unite communities and expand the opportunities for the students and the families that are in those communities that meet the needs of being a full-service community school. They like the strong academic stress in the subject matters that's being taught in the full-service community schools and the administrative leadership that they get in full-service community schools. They like the shared leadership between family and community leaders with the school district, the cities, the county people that are working on the full-service community schools to the families that belong. The school, the full-service community schools are the community hub, and other neighborhoods in the larger areas want to be like them and want to have the services from 6 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning to past midnight, where the full-service community schools are doing their work. There's transformative family engagements going on in every one of the full-service community schools that we funded. And there's health and social supports and continued youth development, not only in the academics, but social and mentally too, mental health kind of focuses where they're needed. What has happened with the community schools that I'm more so closely tied to is that we've got them in 2 elementary schools in our area, 1 middle school, and now we're ready to take those kids from the elementary that we took to the middle school to take to the high school level. That hasn't happened, to my knowledge, in at least northeastern Minnesota, where the kids have this full service, community action and family action with coordination and authority that's worked. And we're just at the cusp now of this experiment. Of taking the same group of kids from K through 10 to through 12. And we're going to go there, no matter what. But we need to continue to be part of, and the language has to be inserted in this bill, because this new step is going to lead the way for all those people that are applied but there wasn't enough money for the schools across the state that want to join the model of the full service community schools. And so I just think we would weaken what we've done in the 13-14 and then the 14-15 sessions in going forward if we don't somehow include full service community schools as part of our priority plan for education across the state of Minnesota. And Madam Chair, I wanted to talk to you about the amendment, and I didn't have the opportunity, and I'm hoping that maybe without the money we can include language for full service. And I know that at some point in time, I just hope that at some point in time as we're going along, the targets are going to change and we're going to have more money added to our program. And so I want full service community schools to be a part of the discussion of the final amount of monies that we have to spend. And without this amendment, I couldn't get it in any other way. But I don't know what your reaction is, if you're going to oppose or if you're going to offer me a place in the bill other than on the spreadsheet with zero. That really upsets me. And like I said, as I started out, I sure don't like where the money's coming from, because that's something I strongly believe in. And so we just took the new money, but we've got to get the intent of full service community schools. We've got to have them out there. And like I said, the people that praised the bill yesterday, I laud them because they worked hard, and they, yesterday again, they delineated what they were going to do with the money. And I just know that if our language is in here, more schools are going to be applying. And so it has to be a bigger number. And so we have to work on that in the new target. But I know we're not having a new target today.
That is true, Representative Murphy. And I know how passionate you are about this topic, and I know in the previous biennium we were able to squeeze out a little bit of money for it, and you know, I think it is a good program in that. Unfortunately, I just wasn't able to do that, and I know you don't like taking it out of there, and I don't like that either. The early learning scholarships is something that I think is really important. So unfortunately, I'm not going to support your amendment because of that. But again, you do have my commitment to continue working on this. If we can, as I said, I would anticipate that our target will not be smaller or narrower than it is right now, as this bill moves into conference with the Senate and obviously in working with the commissioner and the governor's office. So certainly it will be something that we'll be talking about, and I will try to carry your passion, although I don't think I can do it justice, but for this funding and for the full service community schools into those discussions.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to walk along with you and help you carry.
Thank you.
And I don't want to have anyone at this table, my committee members, to have a bad vote on the issue. So I withdraw my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
But I'm going to keep walking.
I know you will. And I'm glad.
And that's another thing I learned at the Full Service Community School Manager is the walk-along program. You know, all those years that I was a teacher, the best behavior modification theme I had was a 6-inch piece of string for a kid whose behavior I was trying to modify. And a pair of scissors. And when the kid didn't come up to my expectations on good behavior, I would clip a quarter inch off the piece of string. And when the string got down to about 2 or 3 pieces, the kid started worrying because what was going to happen. And each kid that might have misbehaved, I had maybe 3 strings in my drawer at a time. Then they'd get worried. And I would still clip, but maybe not a quarter inch. And so it didn't go down. But if it was a big misbehavior, it got a bigger clip than a little one. But somehow or another, by the end of the time period, the string never ran out. But behavior was modified. And the kid thought he was pulling something over on me. But when I was at the full service community school in the middle school, I learned that they didn't use things like string anymore, but if there was a kid that was being disruptive in some way, there was a person that the teacher could call. And the person would appear at the door, and the kid would go on a walk with that person and tell their story, tell what was wrong with them, and to just talk in general about things. And the walker that came to pick up the kid kept the kid as long as was necessary till they cooled down, until they... It's much better than putting in a timeout room. They were exercising. Maybe they were outside by the garden. Maybe they were talking to the school counselor even. And so that walk along really taught me that maybe we could do that at the legislature so I can walk along.
I was just thinking the same thing.
You know, let's work on that.
I'm with you on that one.
All right.
All right, So, Representative Murphy, I appreciate very much you sharing that story. I love it. I wish I had had that little tip when my kids were little. But you are withdrawing your amendment.
I don't hear that correctly
at this time. All right. So, Representative Murphy withdraws the A27 amendment. And A29, I think, Representative Dabney, are you taking that one?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay. Because I had it for Representative Slocum, but she's not here, so.
Representative Slocum, unfortunately, isn't feeling well, too.
All right. Thank you. So, A29. On that one.
So, I'd like to so move the amendment, Madam Chair, if I may speak to it initially.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Dabney to the A29 amendment.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And this kind of goes to when the Sunup Foundation was before the committee. And there were positive reports, and I'll certainly take those at face value. But that day I raised the issue that there's a lot of good folks out there doing good work in the after-school space, as we call it nowadays, and that developing a program that expanded beyond a couple of districts or maybe even a couple of school sites in those districts would be a positive for students across the state, move us towards having a more systematic approach and pairing education with youth development opportunities, exposing kids to mentoring and leadership, engaging the community, and allowing them, I think, to follow their interests, to explore their interests, to get some academic support where that was needed, and maybe have some fun. And so bolstering the after-school community learning grants, as suggested in this amendment, would be a way to do that and make it an option for students across the state.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would, recognizing the target you have, and while we all may lament the source of funding for this proposal, I would also point out that 3- and 4-year-olds grow up, and that they need care and support and assistance and opportunities after they grow up as well. What I would like to do to respond to the mix of concerns there, Madam Chair, if I could, would be to divide the amendment on page 2 between lines 2.4, between lines 2.3 and 2.4, I believe, is the proper spot.
All right. So, and Ms. Para or Mr. Strom, just looking at this, it appears to me that we can divide the amendment. Does this work? So we would have sort of the language of the grant program, if you will, but not the funding component.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
That would be a hope that as you're walking along, you could pick up something. Along the way.
Good thread, Representative. Yeah, good thread. Okay. All right. Well, you know, I know I had a great meeting with the after-school folks, Ignite, mm-hmm. and sort of the coalition around that. And, you know, I like the work that they're doing. Again, unfortunately, in this role, it's one of those things where I have to say no to a lot of things that are great. So I would, if you're willing to divide the amendment in the spirit of hoping that on the walk along there may be some funding for this, I would be happy to accept the first part of this amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also think we've now hit our theme for the day.
Divide and...
I was more thinking walking along, but we can go with yours.
There's a couple of themes at work here, so walking along and maybe even divide, and you'll get part of the vote. I don't know. So,
absolutely.
Okay. So, all right. So the amendment is divided, so I'll just go ahead and ask for... members, the A29 amendment up through line 2.3, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. So that is adopted. And then the remainder of the amendment?
I would like to withdraw that.
Okay. So lines 2.4 through the 2.18 has been withdrawn. All right. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members.
All right, let's see what we got here.
You better walk with her.
All right. A34, Representative Moran, I think that is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I would just like to share that in thinking about authoring this amendment, I get it with a heavy heart because it comes from the Early Learning Scholarship, something that I wholeheartedly believe in. As an early learning educator myself for many years, I know the importance of values of kids getting a great start. But we also heard in this committee over and over again what students are bringing into the classroom, into the building. We have heard about the impact of the opiate epidemic that is impacting like mothers and fathers and parents, and that impacts children and the weight that they carry into the classroom. We've heard about trauma. We've heard about toxic stress and adverse childhood experiences. And we know that what goes on in homes, what goes on in communities, impact how those kids come into the classroom. And we have done a wonderful, wonderful job of investing in mental health in this body, because we know that it is really impacting how individuals are able to live. And the greatest impact would be the impact that our kids and the burdens that our kids are coming to the schoolroom expecting to sit down and learn and achieve and do well. And I would say, as we talked about funneling kids of color into, you know, special education class, that's trauma. A lot of that is trauma that these young people are then impacted with. And the need to help them reconnect it to mental health services is crucial in looking at educational outcomes. I was never more disheartened when I don't remember what school the young people was coming from, but made a as they testify about his parents and the addiction that they were being haunted with, as that he was a part of as a little kid, as a very young kid. And that really impacted who he was in middle school and then currently in high school. So my hope is that, you know, that if we're going to look at creating a pathway in a process where all our kids are able to be successful in school, but also address an issue that is just staring us all in our face, and know that schools cannot do it alone, that they cannot do it alone, that creating a pathway that we can lead mental health grants that can really support the needs of the school is, to me, is just a way that we need to look at how we are, you know, really looking at the whole child and not just looking at the schools, looking at teachers and looking at the body and looking at MCAs, you know. That is a challenge for kids to even be successful at if we cannot address their mental health needs. So my hope is that you can accept this amendment and create a pathway to address the huge mental health problems that we have across the state within our school systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And just to make sure I'm clear about this, so the money that for this is coming out of the early learning scholarships, is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, well, I think Representative Moran.
Both part of, you know.
Yes. Understood. I hope my work and commitment in this area has been demonstrated through working on trying to increase funding for school-linked mental health grants. I know I did work hard to achieve additional funding from what's in the base in the supplemental appropriations bill last year. I have spoken with Chairman Dean, Representative Dean, and his staff on HHS Finance Committee about what their plans may be in terms of increasing that. I believe right now it's, I think it's $11 million that goes into that. And I am hopeful, although obviously I don't think their bill is out or finished, but I am hopeful that they will be planning to increase that as they are able. So in light of those conversations and that, and because of the sources from which it's coming from, regretfully I'm opposing your amendment, but again, we do need to do more to help with the mental health issues that are increasing in our schools. As I said, as I've toured schools, greater Minnesota, small rural school districts, larger suburban districts, urban, when I start to hear the same themes emerging wherever I go, I know that this is a problem that we need to key in on. And without a question, increasing demand for mental health services to help students cope with whatever is happening in their lives is something that's going on in our schools. So, again, committed to continue working on that, but I respectfully am going to oppose your amendment. Other comments? Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you. And certainly your efforts last session were appreciated, where this bill left with a small amount for school-linked mental health that later got transferred over to the HHS committee, where I would certainly agree, I think, that it belongs. Rather than here, it's one of those odd little interactions. This committee handles funds that actually go to the higher education system but somehow get booked against the K-12 budget. But I just want to remind, so there's no question as to your genuineness on support for this program. I'd just like to point out to members that the funding that Representative Moran has proposed here would serve just about 1,500 students across the state. That's 1,500 kids and their families. That's 1,500 classrooms across the state. That's a significant impact on the students and the schools. And as you implied, Madam Chair, it's a statewide need. And as I know, as I talk to superintendents, this is often the number one or number two issue that they have, is finding ways, finding resources to deal with the very real and present and apparently and disturbingly growing mental health needs of kids across the state. And this is an opportunity to provide the tools that those kids need in a place and a time and a setting that works for them and their families. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
If I can just add something very quickly to this, because it just occurred to me, and I do want to thank you for your efforts last year. That's vitally important. Just the last couple of days, I saw a report, or I read the summary of a report. I think it's a Brookings Institute report. And they entitled the report this, but they referred to, in quotations, a disease of despair. And what they did is they tracked out the impact of a number of big public health things that have been happening for quite a while, and I think were part of what produced the voting patterns in the last election cycle. And in it, they track things like obesity, suicides, all sorts of addictions, particularly, of course, opioid and meth addictions, as well as alcohol. And what they found was that while those have been in the rise across our nation for a while, that there are some distinct patterns to it. And some of the patterns have to do with geographics. What they found was an accelerated pattern happening in non-urban areas across the country, so rural and ex-urban communities. They also found some pretty distinct patterns happening racially and culturally, with some big impacts for white rural members, citizens of our society, which is really kind of mind-boggling when you think about, historically, where we've been, where you've had some really, and I think you still do, but where you've had some really strong, positive, forward-looking kind of psychologies precisely from those communities across our country. I mention it because, and I don't think I need to convince you, but I mention it because I think what the report tells us is that this whole issue, and it goes to the last point that Representative Davy made, I do fear that we've got a growing issue in regards to mental illness issues. It has been stereotypically focused on big urban centers, racial ethnic communities. It is apparently really a cross pan-citizen issue across our nation now. And I think whatever we can do to step up our ability to intervene early, which is what school-based mental health services allow us to do, is a wise thing for us to do. I don't need to convince you. I think you understand that. But I just want to make it, for the record, that we need to consistently double down on this kind of investment. And I do hope that as this bill moves forward and our conversations, the legislature moves forward with how we use the people's, taxpayer funds, that this really continue to become a high priority for us. So, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your indulgence on that.
Representative Mariani, any additional comments? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the A34 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted. So A35?
That's my amendment, and I would so move.
All right. Representative Mariani moves the A35 amendment to your amendment.
And Madam Chair, we had part of this conversation earlier when we were debating the pros and cons of Representative Erickson's earlier amendment. So this is the language that has to do with a requirement by the Department of our Commissioner of Education to do two things. One is to submit the state plan, pursuant to the ESSA requirement. And then the second part is to direct that the Commissioner of Education not implement the state plan until the legislature has approved it. So that's currently in the proposed bill before us. And so my amendment would seek to move that out. And I sent a note in just to technically see, because I really want to hone this conversation, and I'm getting kind of like, nah, don't do it. It's fine. My hope was that there was a way to divide this amendment, and physically I'm looking at it like, it's tough to do. But the intent here was really to argue less the issue of submission of the plan and more this issue of requiring legislative approval of it before it goes forward. I think that there are some interrelated problems with both of those, but I do think that there is some distinction there that if I had been more careful in drafting this amendment, I would have directed us to it. So we'll leave the amendment as is, and then just I'll make my arguments for it. Madam Chair, members, there's a couple things. One is that we may be running into, we don't know yet, but we may be running into federal preemption issues here. We are, after all, talking about federal funds. We're not talking about state funds. There is a legal requirement that applies to all states and the Department of Education in terms of a direct relationship with our I think the term is SEA and the Department of Education, so that they can negotiate out and act out the requirements of the federal government as they forward resources to the state. I think that the language in the bill is going to run into, I think it's going to run into problems relative to that longstanding relationship between states and the federal government. The submission thing, becomes less of an issue for me. It's too bad I can't divide it, but I think the spirit here, we heard it earlier in Representative Erickson's amendment and Representative Thiessen's articulation of some principles. I think it makes a lot of sense to make sure that even though there is this relationship between the federal government and our SEA, I hope I'm using the right term, which is our Department of Education, and where the governor has every right under federal law and rule to move forward without legislative action. That even though that exists, I think it's absolutely correct. I'm a member of the legislative branch that we consistently push to make sure that we're part of decision-making processes, that we're fully informed, that we have ownership of whatever it is the department and the governor is going to forward to the federal government. And you can't do that if you're not getting the report and the plan from the department. But a bigger issue really has to do with this thing about that the plan can't get implemented until the legislature has approved it. Setting aside what does approval mean, which is we really ought to talk about. There are, and also setting aside the fact that they're planning on having this proposal in September, they could get a quick turnaround for the federal government, days even, certainly within a month. So, so if we get approval from the federal government in October, where are we? We're not in session in October. And so that goes to the whole issue of the legislature approving it. I would argue that I think what that means is that we have to be officially convened so that we can officially act in the legal framework consistent with the federal government's expectations. If we can't do that, then basically what we have, I would argue, is a frozen scenario here. And the implications could be huge. Again, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars just through Title I alone that comes through ESEA to our state. Plus, there's a number of other federal programs that travel through USDOE, including 21st Century Funds, which are big for many of our communities across the state. All of that could arguably be put on hold until the legislature convenes to approve the plan, which, again, by the way, the federal government doesn't require us to do as a legislature because there's a legal framework that says the relationship is between the governor and the SEA and the USDOE. So I think we're creating an incredible, I understand the spirit of what's happening here, and I empathize with it, but I think we're creating a problem here for our state. And I think we're also creating a problem for our school districts across the state who, after all, have to know and understand what are their mandates and requirements in order to receive federal funds. You know, what kind of data will be collected, what kind of analysis has to be done, what plans need to be submitted. All of that, arguably, is going to be put on hold until the legislature convenes in order to approve the plan according to the language in the bill before us. So I'm not offering this amendment to separate ourselves off from ownership of this. I think we ought to have ownership. The amendment basically argues that this is the wrong way to do it, and I think we're running a huge risk relative to the established decision-making process between states and the federal government. And so I would really urge you, members, to seriously consider this amendment and vote it up. It's not a partisan issue. You know, it's a practical issue for our state. I know there's a tension in terms of how much does the executive branch get to do. I'm a legislator. I get it. I constantly have pushed up against the executive branch. I think that's our role. But I think we have to push up really smartly and within the legal frameworks that have been established. So, members, I would urge adoption of this amendment. And Madam Chair, if there are questions, further questions, we can certainly ask Mr. Uni to come forward again and answer or attempt to answer any of the questions relative to the impracticalness, I would argue, of the language before us inside the bill.
Oh, thank you, Representative Mariani. Are there any questions, or does anyone need clarification from, excuse me, from the department? Unless. All right. No, it doesn't appear so. Well, Representative Mariani, I am going to oppose your amendment. Again, we had a kind of discussion on this on the earlier amendment that Representative Erickson proposed. And again, I think this just ensures that the legislature is going to be equal partners or partners in this process. And that has been the expressed intent, but leaving this language in the bill ensures that that's the case. And I think it's important that we retain this language. So I'm going to respectfully oppose your amendment. Any further discussion? Representative Mariani.
I totally empathize with your position. I chaired the policy committee where I've been very insistent on that kind of ownership. And so I understand your argument, and I empathize with it. I just think this is impractical, and I think we're buying a big problem here, and I suspect you may well be in conference committee with this language, with, you know, legal advice that says, you know what, frankly, you can't even do this. And, you know, but I leave that to you, you know, in terms of what you're going to have to deal with going forward.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And, I, you know, if that's the case, I would imagine that's not going to fall on deaf ears. So, with that, the question is on the A35 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted. We're Representative Dabney, A37.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A37 amendment to be before the committee.
All right. Representative Dabney to the A37 amendment.
Give me just a moment. Madam Chair, the bill before us establishes a new program, and this targeted compensatory program delinks compensatory funding from the formula, threatening funding for school districts across the state. If I remember correctly, over 300 school districts across the state receive compensatory funds, and then sets up this new program with an odd little requirement in it, in that it requires that school districts achieve a certain level of participation by students in MCA testing. And this amendment removes that provision, and it does so for a couple of reasons. We use the MCAs for a number of purposes. Unfortunately, they're only designed for one, and that was to test whether schools were implementing the state academic standards. But now we use them for that, and we use them for teacher evaluation. There's been many proposals over the years that we use them for grading schools, A, B, C, D, F grading systems. These are not what the tests were designed for. They're not appropriate uses of the test. The federal, the SSA, to pick up, you know, continue that conversation, says very specifically, you're supposed to have 95% participation, and then tells school districts, and you have to tell parents that they've got rights too. And that right includes the right to opt your child out. If you find that your child is distressed, overly distressed by the testing, if you find that the data that you receive is not of value, if you find that there's better data out there, there's any number of reasons why a parent wouldn't support their child taking the MCA tests. I think we should support parental decision-making here. And it's not just parents who question the value of the MCA scores. The recent Office of Legislative Auditor report on standardized testing, let me quote page 76. Principals and charter school directors responding to our survey about experience with standardized tests. The academic leaders were vehement in their criticism of the MCAs, using colorful terms like pointless, unfair, draconian, ineffective, a joke, obsolete, waste of time, and massively inaccurate. I remember the school leader that I spoke to from a high-poverty school here in St. Paul a few years ago, who simply referred to them as an autopsy of no value to the student at all. The A37 amendment simply respects parental choice and authority, and as well as the purposes for which the MCA was designed, by removing it from this new targeted compensatory program. And with that, I would ask for member support.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And first, I just wanted to call on either Mr. Strom or Ms. Pera to, I just want to be clear, because I think you referenced schools not receiving this compensatory funding if they don't have 95% participation. So the way the language in the bill is structured is that schools would receive funding, but their amount of funding might go down commensurate with their MCAs. But I just want to make sure that so that Mr. Strom explains that, so there's no misunderstanding on how the language in the bill is proposed.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, there's three parts essentially to that. The first, as you mentioned, was that the compensatory is held at its baseline level, delinked from the regular formula allowance increase and essentially frozen at its baseline level. That's step one. Then step two is an amount of money is added in the new targeted grants, and that's set at $11 million statewide for fiscal year 18 and $15 million statewide for fiscal year 19. And that amount then is distributed to districts on a free and half reduced lunch count, so on the count without concentration, essentially. So every district that has free or reduced lunch will be receiving some of that money, but since it's not concentrated, it may be a different distribution than under the baseline if it were still linked. And then the third change is that that amount is then scaled by the percent of the students at that site taking the MCA test. If the participation rate is at 95% or above, there's no scaling. In the second year, we'll use that as an example just because the math's easy. There's $15 million in this targeted revenue account. There's 300,000 free and reduced lunch students, so the revenue per free and reduced is $50 per pupil. That amount then is the third change, as I mentioned, is scaled by the percent participation in the MCA. So, for example, if a district were at 96%, they would get the full $50 for each of their compensatory eligible students. If they were at 75%, you'd take the ratio of 75% to 95%, and the revenue would be scaled by that amount. So essentially, as the participation rate drops, that amount at each site goes from $50 to a lower level based on the participation level. If there were a zero participation level, it would go all the way to zero. But if there were a 10% participation rate, it'd be 10/95 of the $50 that would go out. So, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, that's sort of the three parts to that. First, the delinking. Second, the new targeted amount calculated on a non-concentration base. And then third, the weighting by the MCA score.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I just thought it was important just to make sure that members understood how this proposal is, how it is proposed to operate if adopted and moved along the process. So, Representative Dabney, then with regards to your comments on that, and again, we had this discussion in committee when we did the walkthrough. Excuse me. Parents would still absolutely have the right to opt out, and I respect that, and it's communicated to parents, and they always have that right. But I am troubled when I look at some of the MCA participation rates, and if you look at grade schools, it's virtually 100%. It's like 98%. So for whatever comments were made in the auditor's report, and that'll be the third point I'll make, you know, schools seem and parents seem to be embracing this from third grade through eighth grade. It's only when we get into high school that we see significant drop-off, and it's not everywhere. And so I am concerned by that because the MCAs is the one test that we have that measures how students are doing according to our standards, to our state standards, what we expect them to be educated to. And while it's not the end-all, be-all, it doesn't tell you everything you need to know about a student, I would argue that as well very strongly. But it is an important measure of something that we need to know. Are our teachers knowledgeable on the standards, and are they instructing their students in a way that they're imparting the standards we expect them to learn? And when we're having discussion about this the legislative auditor's report that came out and some of the comments that were made that you quoted from that, you know, the auditor's report also revealed that a lot of either teachers or curriculum directors or others within our schools don't know how to interpret the data from the MCAs, which I think is very disappointing and probably a failure on I don't know, on our part or on the part of the department and communicating that, or somehow there's a breakdown in our system of making sure that if these are tests that our students are taking, that staff should be knowledgeable on how to interpret that data. And that's, I think, a generally very widely embraced practice in education, that you need to be able to interpret data and use data to inform instructional decisions. So I think those are all important components to this discussion. And I don't understand in whole or in part sort of the what appears to be a growing opt-out movement. But I would expect that if parents are finding value in not opting their students out from third through eighth grade, perhaps there's not enough communication with parents about why these tests are done, what we can learn from them. They are an indicator, at least one of the ones that we look at in terms of how we're doing and trying to close the achievement gap, remove that opportunity gap with students of color in our state. So I think those are all important measurements and things that we need to know as we're looking at whether or not our efforts to improve educational attainment for all students in the state of Minnesota are being successful. So I don't support your amendment. I don't support your amendment, and I'll just open it up for comments or questions at this point. Representative
Debbie. Well, I'll get ahead of the line. One of the thorns in the side of educators since the MCAs and their predecessors were developed is their high-stakes test, but only for the school and not the student. And so there's always been a gap between, and this is touched on in the OLA's report, the motivation of the student over the motivation of, over the accountability to the school. I take the test. Doesn't really matter how I do on the test. I'm giving the test, it matters a lot, but I can't control the outcome. This takes that gap and puts a financial penalty on it. I think you've had high school students, I've got one now. When I look at, is she going to be prepared for college, I look at her grade point average, because the colleges are going to look at her grade point average. They're not going to look at her NCA score. That's a better, more valuable measure for me of how she's doing and how well prepared she is than an MCA. I'm going to look at her PSAT score, because the colleges are going to look at her PSAT score. They're not going to look at her MCA. I'm going to look at her ACT score, because the colleges are going to look at her ACT score, not her MCA score. There simply are, if we're talking about the student, better measures for how a student is doing and how prepared they are. And I would suggest that's why you see growing number of opt-outs across the state by parents. And to penalize schools because students are choosing, and families are choosing to opt out, as is their legal ability, their right, as they have by law been informed of by their schools, to penalize them, I think, makes little sense. There are simply better measures that for many parents about how their child is doing. They're looking to those. I think we should respect the rights of those parents and not penalize their schools for doing that. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I think there's at least a couple of issues here, and not just one. And I frankly, and although I appreciate Representative Dabney's perspective, I frankly don't want to just focus on the merits of standardized summative tests. I think Americans are kind of figuring it out, quite frankly, that there are limitations to what those things are and what they mean for their students. I think it's different from saying that folks don't find value in them. I think smart Americans are figuring out that it doesn't tell me everything I need to know. And so part of the resistance that's happening across the country, and it is across the country, is that Americans are pretty smart people, and they're figuring out that this heavy dependence on this one single assessment is something that could be potentially actually harmful to their kids, as well as potentially providing some valuable information. However, for me, I think the issue here relative to the language before us is, if your position is the opposite of this, of what I just articulated, why are we targeting the potential negative income of this to compensatory revenue? It seems to me that this, the reason for compensatory revenue has nothing to do with, this debate of whether folks are opting in or opting out of participating in the standardized summative testing regime. We have been very clear what the purpose of compensatory revenue has been from the very inception, and this now adds a whole new dynamic that I would argue is actually inequitable. I mean, if we're really serious about taking the opposite position of Representative Dabney, then I think we ought to tie this to the general formula appropriation. Why just mess around with the compensatory? Why attach it to any other category of funding? Why not just tie it to the entire? Representative Marquardt, you and I had a bit of this conversation years ago when we created the world's best workforce. We ran into a heck of a buzzsaw, as we challenged our public schools and said, under this criteria, which is the state accountability, we're going to hold the general formula over your heads. And you and I started actually with a pretty larger percentage, and we were able to, get down to whatever it is now, 3%, I think it is, which is 2%, which is still important, right? And we were able to do that without, just taking it away from school districts. The whole point was we have high expectations, and we're going to, because it's such importance to us, we're going to hold you accountable to this, but we're going to do it in such a way that's helpful. I don't see the way that's helpful in this proposal, number one, and I also don't see, if this is as important as what's being articulated here, why we're limiting it to the compensatory revenue regime. I mean, why is it that we're going to push this forward, quite frankly, on the backs of our lowest income kids and the schools that they go to? Why not all our schools? So it's not a position I would adopt, frankly, because I just reject the whole primacy, of our MCA tests, even as I embrace their importance. However, I find a pretty deep inconsistency here in terms of social public policy, that if we're saying MCAs are so darn important, one of the ways in which we're going to reinforce this is walking it through the compensatory revenue purpose, which is really meant for something else, really meant to be helpful in dealing with low-income status in our society. So, members, I don't think I'm convincing anyone here other than how we walked in here in the first place. But I think it's important that we get these things out on the record, and I think Representative Dabney has got the right approach here. I would encourage your support.
Thank you. Additional comments? All right, not seeing any. All in favor of the A37 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Amendment is not adopted. A39, is that Representative Thiessen?
It is, Madam Chair, thank you. And I move the amendment.
All right, Representative Thiessen to the A39 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment, the way it's laid out is a little bit confusing, but basically it does, it really is aimed at doing one thing, and that is to fund the education partnerships at the amount that they came in and asked for. So these are, you know, the Northside Achievement Zones and St. Paul Promise neighborhoods, as well as the groups that are working in Red Wing and Northfield and St. Cloud.
Day
39? Oh, is it Day 39? Yeah. That's what this does.
That's what I call?
Yeah. And then it also provides some funding for some groups that are trying to get started. So some folks in Austin are working very hard on this. There's a group in White Earth that's working hard on this. And so it's basically to get funding for these education partnerships, the Representative Haley bill. And I think this is an incredibly effective model. I know that Madam Chair does as well. And so the way it pays for it, so it's about $4 million additional dollars. And the way it pays for it is, you know, we are allocating $10 million on the spreadsheet for the sale of Crosswinds. I'm not aware that that number is actually, that there's any basis for that number particularly. We invested $23 million of state bonding money when that school was built. And so I imagine that the value of the school is more than $10 million. And so how we're paying for this amendment would be to move, and it doesn't say this in the actual language of the bill, but it would be to move the line item on the spreadsheet from $10 million to $14 million that we would expect from the sale of the Crosswind School. And then pay for the educational partnerships full funding that way. And I know that there's folks that came from Austin and otherwise, if people have further questions about the educational partnership work that they're doing, that would now be funded under this bill that's not currently being funded, those Tier 3 partnerships.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. I'm just trying to track within your amendment, because I know there's another amendment that was filed that references moving that Crosswinds amount to $15 million, but that's the A44. I don't know if I see it in this one.
And Madam Chair, if I could, and maybe Mr. Strong can talk about this, there's nothing in the bill that references the money, the sale of the Crosswinds, one way or the other. But it's on the spreadsheet. And so we weren't sure exactly how to address that issue. That's why there's language in here about a different, a little more specific about how we're going to plan and get proposed purchase price for the Crosswind School. But I do know that we invested $23 million in bond proceeds in that school as a state when it was built, and it's been part of the issue as we've tried to convey these schools because we have a stake in it. I think it's a matter of simply, as a committee deciding, we think that that school is actually worth $14 million, or I think probably more than that, but for purposes of this amendment, $14 million instead of $10 million, and using that money to invest in these education partnership, community education partnership. I can't remember ever what the title that is. I'm sorry. You know what I'm talking about, though.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Okay, so I'm going to set aside the whole Purpich Crosswinds part of this discussion and just focus on the partnerships.
Yeah.
Obviously, budget constraints being what they are, what's proposed in the House Bill 890 that we're considering today does not include funding for the Tier 3, which is sort of the planning grants for communities who want to create these partnerships. And so, so the funding that we have right now is just to continue offering state support to those community partnership organizations that are in existence now. I think just my personal philosophy on this, and again, being that these are clearly public, private meaning any other funds outside of what we may appropriate dollars provided to communities, whether they come from the business community, from individual donors, other foundations that support them, maybe somebody got a federal grant. I think it's important that these organizations be started up and get off the ground with local support before they come to the state for money. And I think that's important because when you have a process that starts in that way and grows from the ground up in the community, and they've got to gather those funds to get this, there is a level of investment and commitment to that and keeping it going that is essential for when maybe a particular source of government money, whether it be state or federal or otherwise, may not come through as anticipated. That, again, there is a local level of commitment to keeping those organizations going. And, again, members can certainly feel free to disagree with me on that, but that's just kind of how I approach these things. And so, again, with having to make some difficult decisions on some of the budget requests and trying to at least put some money into areas that I thought were important, I wasn't able to do the level three. And so I just wanted the committee to have the benefit of my thought process on that. So, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things, and I should have been clear on this before. In addition to the tier three, and I'll get to that in just a minute, this actually increases the funding for tier one and tier two as well. And in particular for tier one, I think the increase in funding in the bill is a few hundred thousand dollars over where they are. And I think there was testimony, and we know that they've had this federal grant that is going away. And so it does create a big hole in two very successful projects. So this amendment would increase the funding to kind of cover those losses. And as you know, both of those organizations and the tier one are doing tremendous fundraising outside of the state and are getting incredible commitment from people, from nonprofits and from corporate dollars, private funding. And so, and I think the reason, you know, Steve Ballmer was here, who used to be the CEO of Microsoft, and he's looking very carefully at Minnesota's model as a national model. And the thing that he says from the private sector is that one of the reasons they're looking at Minnesota and are attracted here and may be willing to invest here is because the state has put in money. I think we were the first state to put in money into this kind of model. And so I would encourage us to adopt this amendment for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 schools. And I would actually, if we could, to your point, Madam Chair, I think that some of these Tier 3 schools actually have raised money from the private sector and have money coming in. And I know the folks from Austin and some other folks are here that could just take a minute or two to testify to the committee that they, in fact, have brought in private dollars that we would now be matching.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. If the folks from Austin want to come down, very, very briefly, it wasn't my intention to take a lot of public testimony today. And please identify yourself. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Lawhead, and I am the executive director of Austin Aspires. Austin Aspires is a Tier 3 organization within the Education Partnerships Coalition. We did have to meet a series of rigorous criteria to be established as a Level 3, and in our community have obtained initial funding for our first years of work through the Hormel Foundation, Hormel Foods Corporation, and Mayo Clinic Health Systems. So we have had that private funding to get the work started in our community. With that money, we have come together to identify goals, data points to capture, and cultivated citywide support from schools, public and private, nonprofits, public sector, and the business community. So thank you for this opportunity to testify. I hope you'll support our important work so we can close the opportunity gap in Minnesota by engaging the whole community in accountability for the outcomes for our students.
Thank you. Any questions? Right, thank you very much. Thank you for your information and your brevity. We appreciate it. So
Madam Chair, if I'm happy. We can cut out the purpose language. That was kind of a placeholder to explain that part. Mm-hmm. We don't really need that language, frankly, in here. And if that's a whole other separate issue. So we don't need to get in that. But I just, frankly, remember. I do think that this fact that we have the $10 million on, you know, from the sale of Crosswinds built into this budget. We know that we invested $23 million in that school. And I think that there were, because we have matching requirements, there had to be additional money put into constructing that school. I think $10 million is underestimating the value that we can get from the conveyance of that school. And if that's the case, and I really think it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, if there was actually analysis done to come up with the $10 million number, because then maybe I'm mistaken on that. But I don't know why we wouldn't take advantage of what I think is going to be money coming from the sale of that school, from the conveyance of that school, and invest in these programs that are really good. I mean, it's easy, Madam Chair, to do, right? I mean, it's not costing us anything. And we can actually do stuff that I think everybody on this committee bipartisanly supports. So I would ask people to roll on, get this built into the budget, and then as we go into conference committee, we're going to have a much stronger position supporting. You know, the governor did not put money into these programs in his budget, and so I think the strongest position that we can have going into conference committee to do this, the better off we're going to be. And it doesn't cost us anything.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And again, as I said, I think you know I'm a supporter. People on this committee are supporters of the partnership. But I would say with regards to where the money comes from, those discussions are ongoing. And as members will recall, this will be the fourth school that was built by the, I believe, by the taxpayers and run through integration districts that we then have had to look at conveying to someone else. None of the other schools have had to pay anything for them. And so while it would be my hope that we're going to be able to get there, there is some resistance to this, and this is a new concept.
Well, and Madam Chair, I mean, if that's the case, then when you come to the floor, your bill is out of order. I mean, you can't have it both ways. I don't know why you wouldn't take this as a very easy way to get money to the education partnerships. You know, otherwise you're $10 million. I mean, if that's the argument, then your bill is $10 million out of order, and we're going to have to find $10 million other dollars to cut. So I don't know why we wouldn't just take the $14 million. And then we're both on the hook on this one, right? And we don't have to rise on the floor to make a point of order. I just think... if $10 million or $14 million, and we can actually do some good work and go into conference committee with a stronger position on these education partnerships, I just think the better off we are.
Well, thank you, Representative Thiessen. Again, I don't think there's nothing that says we can't ask schools to pay for it. It just hasn't been the practice. And so, again, entering into these discussions, we've come up with, we've been working what we think is a reasonable amount, but I am hesitant to go beyond what we've provided for in the bill and tying funding to it at this point. Additional funding beyond the $10 million. So, additional comments? All right, with that, the question.
Now, I'd like a roll call.
All right. Representative Thiessen requests a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
On the amendment, Representative Loon.
No.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Anthel. Yeah, so Representative Erickson. No. Representative Juergens.
No.
Representative Grisha is absent. Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Markwart?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Sandstein?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Holcomb's absent. Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Thiessen?
Yes.
Representative Mills.
All right, there are 7 ayes and 11 nays. The amendment is not agreed to. All right, I have a Slocum Amendment, A41. This, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take that. If I could please move the A41. If you'd give me just a moment, please. Madam Chair, at the beginning of the year, we opened with everyone around the table identifying what their goals were for the year. And I think pretty consistently, pretty unanimously, closing that achievement gap was a big part of it from almost everyone. And what we know is that for some kids to be more successful in school, they simply need more time. One of the bits that I often come back to representing an urban area is the summer loss, where kids are doing well in the spring, and you know we can assess maybe through the MCAs, maybe better through the NWEA tests where they're at, and they come back in the fall and they're down a little bit. We have very inequitable opportunities for students to have academic experience, enrichment experiences during the summer. And that, when researchers have looked at it, you take the learning loss between first and second grade, and then you add it to the loss between second and third grade, and between third and fourth, and so on. A significant percentage of the achievement gap that we see goes to the inequity in out-of-school time opportunities, particularly during the summer. And if we could close that gap, that opportunity gap, we could make dramatic strides towards closing the achievement gap for Minnesota students. Some kids, like I said, just need a little bit more time after school. They need a little bit longer during the school year to get that math concept, to explore that science concept, to do a host of things. And this, the A41 amendment, looks to amend the formula we currently use for extended time programs. The formula we currently use is based on, I guess, a historic formula amount of $5,117, not the current formula amount. So students are eligible for up to 1.2 times the formula amount for the extended time revenue, but that last 0.2 is on an older, lower formula amount. This, the A41 simply updates us to the current formula amount. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Any other comments to the A41 amendment? And so, Representative Dabney, just to clarify, money is coming from the early learning scholarships as provided for in the bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
And Chair, I would encourage us to support this. And I know that, you know, there's this sort of maybe taboo about going into the early learning scholarships, something that I've supported that initiative. But we're talking about the growth that's inside of this bill. We're not talking about going after the base of those scholarship programs. Unlike what the bill is doing elsewhere, which is basically what it is, dismantling the VPK program. So this is really a measured approach that's attempting to work within the numbers that you've been given, Madam Chair, that this committee has been given by other folks, not folks on this committee. I think it's a responsible thing to do. Madam Chair, you and I both presented on the extended time, the importance of that. We had a very powerful hearing here. I don't think there's a partisan issue relative to the wisdom of using extended time. there are lots of moving parts in this bill. I mean, we've got the delinking issue with compensatory aid, which is going to cost some school districts money. At the same time that we're talking about funds that are targeted for the same kind of students and communities that extended time targets and provides opportunities for. So there's really a muddled message that's going on. I would submit relative to this bill. I think Representative Dabney's amendment presents a much more clear message in this bill, which is that, one, we have a strong belief in this program. Two, we understand the interconnect between it and our present use and logic of compensatory aid. It's all about being able to find the right kind of synergy between those two types of investments. The current bill takes away from that kind of logic. And so this at least attempts to re-knit that logic with compensatory aid and extended time, and does so not by doing damage to the scholarship, early scholarship program at all, but only by going after the growth of the scholarship program that exists in this bill. So I think it's a smart amendment. I think it's a good amendment. I would encourage your support.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Members, I'm going to oppose this. And, you know, I support extended time revenue. I support increasing it. That was, if you recall the hearing, Representative Mariani and I each presented our bills. We had, you know, bills sort of along the same lines but structured a little differently on that. You know, the bill and the compensatory revenue discussion, hearkening back to a previous amendment in that, what the bill is attempting to do is to take the increase in the compensatory revenue and direct it to be used specifically for extended time programs for those students. And the point of this, again, is to be a bit more targeted and directed in those efforts to help students succeed. And I think, you know, we will have an opportunity then to measure progress that is made through those efforts. You know, we've had compensatory revenue in place for a number of years, and, you know, starting out this legislative session, I recall being on a panel discussion with a few other legislative leaders in education on kind of what we face as a state, and school officials were there and school board members and that, and there was a comment made about, you know, not being able to continue doing things how we're doing them now, that we've got to maybe make some changes to try to get different results. If you want different results, maybe you have to do something different. And so, again, targeting that compensatory revenue to extended time is again, a concept within the bill to try to do something a little bit different and see if we're going to get better results. So I think that gets to really maybe the point that you're trying to make with this amendment. So I think we're kind of in sync or in of like mind anyway in that manner. And Representative Mariani, you had your hand up.
Well, that's right. I do appreciate your sharing the logic of the chair constructing the finances of the bill relative to this new effort. It bears saying again, though, that, you know, absent runs here before us, it's really difficult to understand what the impact. I mean, I'm just shooting messages to my school district. What's the impact here? And they're saying we don't have runs yet. You know, I just feel like we're having to make decisions here. I understand the logic. I think I get where you're going. I don't know what that impact is precisely because we don't have the instrument before us, and we really should have it before us here today.
Other comments? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the E41 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted. E44 amendment and... Okay, so members, there was a technical drafting error in that, which has been corrected. So the A44-1 has been handed out, and so that will be the amendment we'll be looking at. And I think this is Representative Teason's.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. So this amendment deals with tribal contract schools. and they are federal schools. There's four of them around the state, and they in the 2015 session, we used one-time money, so for one biennium, we used money to, you know, so they get federal dollars from the federal government, and we use money, but that federal money is much less than the average amount of money that we actually have for our per-pupil unit, our per-pupil unit that we send to every other school kid in the state. And so in 2015, the legislature passed a bill to put state money in, essentially to make up the difference between what the federal government is putting in and what our per-pupil formula is. Basically on a pure equity argument, you know, why should the children in these four schools, because the federal government is falling down on the job, be getting a lesser education, getting lesser money than everybody else in the state of Minnesota? I see Representative Erickson is skeptical. So we did that, and they've actually been getting good results. You know, they've used it to hire mental health counselors, to hire reading specialists, and they are making progress to close the gap, the educational gap in these schools. And so what this amendment would do would be to continue that funding. That, you know, it doesn't show up as a cut on our spreadsheet because it was one-time funding, but this is a nearly 40% cut in the money going to these schools. And so I would encourage members to vote for this. I don't know why we would treat certain school students in this state differently than we treat other students. And that's really what this comes down to. And it's paid for, again, and we had two amendments. There was actually the 830 amendment, which I don't know if we withdrew it or it skipped over, that would have paid for it by reducing the amount going to early learning scholarships. I chose not to do that because I think that the early learning scholarships are important too. What this bill does is ups the sale price of the Crosswind sale to $15 million. Again, we have no basis for $10 million. I think with the $23 million that the state put into it, we would get more than $10 million from it. And I don't know why we wouldn't use that money to invest in these schools, which are making a difference. And they're using those dollars that they got. The preliminary results look like they are actually starting to close the achievement gap, starting to improve education outcomes for these students. And so I would encourage people to vote yes on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Other comments to the 844-1 amendment? Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I want to start by thanking Representative Thiessen for pursuing this issue and being so clear and focused on it. In my last comments, I reminded us of the opening of the session where we all talked about wanting to close the achievement gap. If you look at data about how Minnesota students do, it is tragic to recognize that in almost every measure, American Indian students are at the bottom. Graduation rates, academic test, standardized test performance rates, the only places where maybe they're at the top is dropout rates. This is a population that the department and the governor have done a good job of just a few years ago in reworking our American Indian education statute and funding those programs and reaching out and making some positive changes. And we're seeing it in my district. But these four schools are a special different thing, and they are facing a cliff with the loss of state money that they received 2 years ago. Cliffs aren't healthy for kids or other living things, and I would urge members across the aisle, the money going to the Representative Thiessen proposes to continue to these BIE schools is as real as the $10 million that the chair is booking to make her spreadsheet balance. And so there's not a problem here with where the money comes from. The question is whether we want these schools, the children in these schools, to have the opportunities they need over whether we want them to peer over that cliff that is built into the current situation. So I would urge an affirmative vote on the Thiessen Amendment. Let's keep this funding going and give those kids the equal opportunities with their peers off these outside of these schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Other comments? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the A44-1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted.
Can we get a division on that?
Division's been requested. All in favor of the A44-1 amendment, raise your hands. All right, put your hands down. All opposed, please raise your hand. All right, thank you. Put your hands down. Amendment is not adopted. A46, Representative Sandstead, were you offering that amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, I am. I'd like to move this amendment.
All right, Representative Sandstead, you're recognized to your amendment.
Thank you. This is an amendment that, in essence, keeps the Perfect Center open, and in doing so, it requires that a report be given to the legislature by January 15th of 2019. And in that report, they have to identify the actions that they're taking to address the findings of the audit report. So it's basically accountability to fix those issues. It also requires that in the outreach, there's one staff person per art area. And I'm offering this amendment because I've actually heard this bill in a couple different committees. And as I listened to it, I realized last night there was not one person that came before any of the committees and spoke out asking to close Perpich. I heard parents share that they brought this issue before the legislature and asked for an audit, not for the purpose of closing the school, but for the purpose of fixing the problem. They were asking for help to get the school back on track. I heard testimony that Perpich has been a model for other states. And I certainly know it is by far one of the only opportunities our most gifted and talented students in the areas of arts have to go to be challenged to the level of their expertise and in a way that traditional methods can't necessarily provide for. In the past, Perpich has had a strong and proud tradition, and I don't believe that it's beyond getting back there. I think the request was to help get them there, not to close, and that's even in the auditor's report. There were multiple options. And so I feel very strongly that this body would be doing the wrong thing to take action to close it, but rather we need to give them the time and the resources to get back on track. So we're doing the best by our students. And with that, I would ask for your support.
Right, thank you, Representative Sandstead. Further comments?
Madam Chair, could I roll call this, please?
All right, roll call's been requested. Representative Sandstead, and I would say this is probably one of the more difficult issues we're dealing with this session. And I've done this before when we heard the bill that I proposed with Representative Erickson on closing.
closing the agency, closing Purpich. And again, it's something that is troubling, and it's a difficult topic because I've heard from many former students, primarily valuing their education. Although, and I'm sure it was wonderful for many of them, and I think maybe many of us reflecting on the experiences we had in school could maybe say some of the same comments that it helped shape who you are today and that. But again, not taking away from the students and purpose the uniqueness of their educational experience there. And I wanted to make it clear also that it is my hope that an arts high school will continue, whether it looks identical to what's going on right now or not, I think is an open question. But I think the agency as structured has proven over time and over a number of auditors' reports to be broken. And again, in my opinion, it's not fixable in the current structure the way it is. So what has been proposed in the bill that we're considering is taking the outreach functions, which was an important reason and component to Purpich as when it was originally authorized and looking into the history of this, and creating a division, not just a person, but a division within MDE, and I think, you know, appropriately named for Lola and Rudy Purpich to continue outreach. And with the funding that we're investing in that, I think they'll be able to do more than is currently being done by Purpich, with only, I think it was one person and a half staff person working on outreach currently. So that's something that we are, again, thoughtfully trying to continue in a more robust manner that it exists today. So, you know, with regards to continuing and further study on continuing Purpich in the agency, which seems to be sort of the rest of the amendment, I think it just further delays a problem that we have, to be honest. We've had reports. We've got another very serious one, very deep. The problems have been there a long time. And I'm not sure that continuing on for 2 years and giving people hope that somehow 2 years is going to fix a broken agency is the best way to go. So I'm going to oppose your amendment. And as I've said to what Representative Ward and I have talked about this a bit to others, I am really hoping that we can find sort of a new creation or reincarnation of an arts high school with a structure around it that allows it to be successful and to operate in a manner that's one that we would expect of other schools that operate or that educate students in that. And so that's something I'm personally very committed to. But again, the agency is just not something I feel that I can support its continuance. So with that, I felt I needed to offer a little comment and context around my vote today. So, all right. Any other comments, Madam Chair? Oh, Representative Sandstead.
Thank you. I want to thank you for, you know, advocating for a strong school, because I think, in essence, that's exactly what you want to see happen. I understand you don't think that's what has been happening. I do want to just speak to the changes that have been made on the board, significant changes, and the improvements that have been demonstrated in just a matter of a couple of short months. We have a licensed principal now, you know, helping with the educational leadership. They have a new director in place temporarily. They're seeking a new director. I think they're fully aware of what needs to happen. But again, I just would like to remind members, there's been significant change in a matter of months. And I believe the proper staff now is in place or well on its way. And again,
Not one email, not one phone call, not one testimony publicly have I heard asking for this body to close the doors. I did hear them say, please help. Help get us back there. But not one asked for the doors to be closed.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Representative Dabney, did you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I will certainly agree with you that there's been leadership issues of late at the Perpich Center, and I think we're all disappointed at a minimum. But what I'm seeing there is, a new sheriff in town, as Dr. Sanstead indicated, a new principal who certainly was impressive in her vision and presentation here before this committee, a new board that is more representative across the state, and one that is taking bold action. School districts don't close buildings or don't terminate projects lightly. They often do so extremely hesitantly, and this committee doesn't have a history of closing schools either. Here we've got a group with a strong turnaround plan who are taking the sort of exact sort of action we would want them to do. I think we undercut those efforts when we talk about shuttering that school. And instead, we should be supporting that effort, allowing it to play off, working towards the conveyance of crosswinds, and keeping a close eye on the Perpich Center and allowing it perhaps even to expand its current presence under new, more robust, and accountable leadership. So I would urge members to support the Sanstead Amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the challenges that we're having with the Perpich agency is the governance structure. When you have an appointed individuals that are from congressional districts, there seems to be a disconnect between the accountability with the stakeholders and, most importantly, the students. And I think that there's a way that we can structure this school that will have more accountability that is more in the traditional model, whether it's a charter school, a public school, under another independent school district, or something of that nature, so that we could still continue to offer students wonderful arts opportunities. And as Representative Loon has in her bill, that there is that outreach part in her bill still. And I think that this could be a lot better way for parents, students, board members, that can be much more accountable to providing the quality programming, as well as having the accountability measures that Representative Loon brought up. So I hope that we continue to have this conversation, because it is something that I think that we do value in this state. But I feel that the governance structure that's in place has been problematic. We've seen it time and time again over the years. And I think that if we address it in this way, we can do a better job for our students. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, and then to Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I remember a conversation I had with Governor Perpich, and he was saying, Mary, they tell me you're not on board with our school. And I said, no, Governor, I'm not on board with our school, because you would be taking, in my opinion, be taking the most talented of the kids out of our local high schools and sending them to this premier school in the big city. And I don't know that I'm for that because of what it takes away from what we already have. And then Governor Perpich arranged that the next group of people that went to the Fame High School in New York to see how successful that school was would have an additional guest going with them then I went to this New York, which I had not been to but one other time, and saw this high school in this high rise and saw these floors from 40 to 58 or something. They were all different floors. One were dance floors, one was a theater, and the singing and the individual lesson kind of things that the students that were engaged in all parts of their activities were in this big building that was so different from any school I had ever seen in my whole life or even thought of. But I still didn't wholeheartedly, when I came back from that, wholeheartedly become a strong supporter of the Purpich School until I had students that I knew from northeastern Minnesota that didn't fit in their schools. They weren't the stars at their school, but had extreme talent and potential and just didn't fit. And they took the opportunity to apply to go to the Purpich School and to talk to their parents as they were juniors and seniors at the Purpich School and have their parents tell me as a legislator that those students finally found a place that they fit. And the experiences they had in reaching their potential because of the training that they received at the Purpich School, and then because of their new acquaintances and people that they were meeting at the Purpich School, gave them new thoughts about where they could apply to go to college. And then to talk to those students after they had gone to college and worked in the real arts world as graduates of fine institutions and see this person, how they were different from when they were 15 years old when I knew them, or when their parents were wringing their hands about how they didn't fit at home. But now they were fitting in backstage direction, or one of my favorite students all time was selling tickets, theater tickets, on Broadway. And that's no easy task. That's a business skill in itself of how to do it and how to plan and how to arrange groups coming in from certain times and so forth. And the life that those people were having, or the experiences that they were having as grown-ups in the world. And one of the students played at Carnegie Hall. And another student that I knew played at Madison Square Garden. Totally different kinds of talents and skills. But who would ever dream that the student from St. Louis County, Albrook, would achieve that? And wouldn't have had achieved that if they hadn't had the opportunity to come to the big city. And I know when you say, in all sincerity, you'll say that another school will grow up in the Phoenix Wave. But I'll bet that there won't be the outreach to the rural areas or the experiences of kids to have this one chance to apply to a state school, be accepted, and the door will open for their potential. And I just don't think You mentioned the auditor's reports, and I have great respect for auditor's reports. But this is the same auditor's report over the years. And every other year, the auditor's report was received and accepted. And we didn't try to fix the problem by closing the school. And I don't think this auditor's report should be any different in that respect. Because all the issues were addressed. And more important, they hatched the board. You know, they did away with the board and got a new board now. And we have, I think, there was no warning that if we did this, we were going to close. We said, I thought that, I don't know what the governor thought, but I'm sure he wouldn't have talked these people into accepting this major new role and stepping out of their comfort zones to accept this public role of becoming the new directors of the Purpose School, that the Purpose School is going to close before they have a chance to do it. And I don't think we're just prolonging the 2 years. I think we're giving these 2 years that if we don't close the school, we'll be giving this board and the next governor the opportunity to build on what this board sets up. And we'll have another 40 years, or 35 years, of successful state school for gifted and talented in all the arts. And give those rural Minnesota kids a chance to reach their opportunities and potentials. I went on too long, I'm sorry. But we see the maps of Greater Minnesota. I mean, we were upset when there was nobody from the 7th District. And that was the fault of the outreach people. But half, the person and a half can't do everything. Like you say, your structure for the outreach should remain with purpose, with the new board governing it. And guidance from the State Department of Education. But don't take the potential opportunities for those country kids to come to the big city. Every kid deserves a chance to fit at some school. And our most talented kids don't always have the chance that they have to stay in their own community.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen. All right, other comments? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've looked at all the other arts and science schools across America. Not a one of them is run by an agency, a small agency. They're either out of the Department of Education or they're private, or they're run through a university. But none is run like Purpich, and that's its downfall. It's a small agency. So I think you're on the right track as you talk about a reformation of, as Representative Peterson said, governance. You can't have a board running an arts education center whose focus is a high school. It's not going to work because they're here today and gone tomorrow. They need some permanent structure. And, of course, the addition of a principal is good, but they need a structure like a school.
Well, Madam Chair, I do now.
Representative
Peterson. I mean, I heard Representative Peterson and Representative Erickson say that. Then why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you actually reforming the structure instead of blowing up the school? And I think I know the reason, because this budget, in many, many ways, and this is my closing statement, I guess, is a negotiating tool instead of an actual budget of what we believe in as an education committee. You're putting this in here as a negotiating chip. You're putting cutting voluntary pre-K in as a negotiating chip when you go to conference committee. That's not what we should be doing. We should be doing the right kind of policy. And so you're doing this to get money in your budget. You got fake money in your budget with the $10 million already, and I'm going to talk to Chair Knobloch about that because you admitted in this committee today that your budget actually doesn't balance. But why are you using these kids' lives and this school's lives as a negotiating chip? You're putting them through hell because you want to be in a stronger position going in to negotiate with the governor. And that's, like, morally repugnant. And it's just terrible.
Representative Thiessen, I think your comments are offensive.
Well, there you go.
And, you know, to make that statement would be for me to assume then you're disregarding everything that was in the auditor's report.
No, it's not at all. We have a proposal not to disregard that, Madam Chair.
Yes, it is. It is basically to continue the process for another 2 years and to study it. And for people who have approached me about my proposal on Perpich or Representative Erickson's proposal to close Perpich, I said, you know what? There were four options provided in the auditor's report. I chose one to offer a bill on. This is my thoughts. Any other member can propose other ideas. And I didn't see any other mid-level proposals coming from you or from anyone else.
You
other
proposed
than
an amendment in your committee on your bill.
Other than continuing as is and to study the problem. So
that's not true. Another option, Madam Chair, was to convey Crossroads, Crosswinds, which we proposed in the amendment we offered, and to let this board do its work, including some requirements some accountability requirements they come back in. So what you're saying is simply not correct, Madam Chair.
Well, the conveyance of Crosswinds is in the bill as well. So I guess we agree on one thing.
Well, we agree. You said that we didn't offer an option that was in the auditor's report, and it was. That was one of the options.
Oh, reclaiming my time. This is in no way a political bargaining chip to use against students or families or supporters of Perpich. I frankly wish we didn't have this issue to deal with, but we do. And it's been going on for a long time, and I think the problems have been swept under the rug for a long time. And as chair of the committee that has a responsibility over billions of dollars, we have to take a serious look at this and do our fiscal responsibility to address it. And again, I have tried to explain my desire to find a solution where we can continue an arts high school, but I have no confidence in this agency structure as it exists. And I don't see that can be regained. But short of that, I am open to solutions for having an arts high school operated under a different structure. And I haven't seen that proposed. And we have time to continue talking about this. But, you know, I really don't think that it's helpful to cast aspersions against other members who we just may happen to have a difference of opinion on this matter and questioning their motives. Again, there are students' education at stake here. I think we've all acknowledged that. But again, I don't know that the current structure really acts in the best interest of students. That's certainly been called into question from the auditor's report. So I hope that we can continue
the dialogue on this issue in a manner that respects the fact that members may come away with a different opinion on what should happen. We are going to have to develop a consensus. I would expect there be some differences, perhaps, with the governor's office. I did note that the commissioner didn't make a specific comment of any kind about purpose yesterday in her remarks. I found that a little odd. But I am open to continuing this discussion in a respectful manner. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to mention, I believe there was another bill by Representative Ward regarding the Purpich Center, which I don't believe was heard, but I do think other options were put forward. And I would just once again ask, please reconsider on this. I would be willing to work with you. I will, if the problem is the structure of the agency, I will work with you to come up with something. I just think shutting the doors now has a far greater and a far-reaching impact on people that are caught in the crossfire, and they're not to blame. And I think this is such a jewel for our state. It has been, it can be, and if there's a problem, I'll work to fix it with you. I just don't think saying, let's find another way of doing this, or another school, or open something else, those are hopeful promises. But we have something currently in front of us that I really do think can be rehabilitated, for lack of a better word, and put back on track. I don't think we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater in this. If our car has a flat tire, we replace the tire. We don't get a whole new vehicle, typically, unless you have an old vehicle like mine. So I invite you, not for a walkabout, but for an interpretive dance with me on this one. I know, it was bad. I will work with you. I believe in accountability. I believe in transparency. I believe they're really on track. And I believe there are some very talented, gifted students that are going to be left out if we close these doors. 2 years, 1 year, there's reports, there's accountability. We need to define what it is that we expect them to do. We need to give them the tools. It should be time-bound, and they should know ahead of time what will happen if the goals are not met. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sunstead. Other comments? All right, seeing none, was there a roll call on this? All right, a roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Loon.
No.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Yes.
Representative Ansel.
No.
Representative Erickson.
No.
Representative Juergens.
No.
Representative Kreisch is not here. Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Marquardt.
Yes.
Representative Moran. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Nornan.
No.
Representative Peterson.
No.
Representative Austin.
No.
Representative Sanford.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Slocum is not here. Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Thiessen.
Yes.
Representative Wills is not here.
There being 6 aye votes and 11 no votes, the amendment is not agreed to. All right, and that is all of the amendments that we have, members. And so would any members like to make closing comments? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, ma'am. The chair and members, I had hoped to be at this point in the session where I could be supportive of an omnibus
K-12 finance bill, and I actually told myself, that's what you're going to do this year, Carlos. And I do think that relative to what we did a couple of years ago, there are some good things here, right? We've got the 1.5 on the formula. Last year, 2 years ago, it was, don't even need to go there. However, there are things here that don't work for me. And frankly, it don't work for a lot of students in my school district, and I would argue don't work for a lot of students in other people's school districts as well. And I think you heard a little bit of the frustration earlier, Representative Thiessen's comments. And for me, I think it has to do, based on the context in which we find ourselves as a state, where I mentioned I was out in Oregon a couple months ago playing hooky from a committee hearing here to explore some education leaders, meet with some leaders out in that state on their teacher color work. And while they have a really powerful framework, that state has a budget shortfall. Their budget shortfall is roughly the size of our budget surplus. That was largely due to a whole different tax structure in our state, where they're attempting to walk on one leg by not having a statewide sales tax in their state. And everyone in their state knows they need to do it because they love their schools. But nobody wants to do the politically, courageous thing of asking their local voters to support their schools with a sales tax. We've asked that question in many different ways, but our tax structure in our state for decades has been solidly committed to having adequately funded public education access opportunities for our students. We're not in Oregon's situation. We're sitting on a healthy surplus. We have a healthy economy. We have, as a result of that, a governor's proposal that came before us that does so much more, not only numerically, but also in terms of different things that we're attempting that he's attempting to address that actually have an impact on schools, like the unfunded pension issue that Representative Mary Murphy speaks about. That has a real impact on the ability of local schools to be able to deliver adequate quality education for students. So there are good things in this bill, but relative to where we're at, this really falls short. We could be doing so much more and doing so much more relative to need. I have to say that the whole issue around the VPK is particularly egregious for me. In my school district, Representative Davin, your school district, I asked, you're looking at 340 children. We call them slots, but they're children who are going to lose access to how they're currently accessing with scholarship to VPK. In my school district, it's well over 200 slots, $1.8 million of resources. Representative Bennett, I don't have your numbers, but I know that you're going to get hit with this issue. Not you, but your school district, your kids. Representative Smith, I don't have your numbers either. But I know you're going to get hit because you've got school districts that participate strongly and have built up, slowly been building up their capacity through their local schools to deliver these services, this access for your young kids and a number of others here. And it would be great if we had some good sheets in front of us so that we can point to each other and ask the question, are you fully informed, of what the policy changes and the finance changes are proposing to do to your school districts. And I hope that we do all get those soon, and I hope we all look very deeply in the mirror and ask ourselves whether whatever vote today we're going to take is going to be the same vote that we're going to take once we're fully informed of the impact. There's lots of good policy in this stuff. There's always going to be good policy. There's also, in my opinion, bad policy in this bill. I get it. It's an omnibus bill. It's going to be a mix and a match. of issues. The point is that this bill, I don't think, really reflects what we ought to be doing in our state relative to where we're at right now as a healthy Minnesota. And Representative Loon, I don't cast any aspersions on you at all. I cast them on all of us. We're the ones who are acting on the instrument before us. We're the ones who have the relationship with the leadership of this institution that has made a decision to give us something that doesn't reflect what's possible and what's needed in the state of Minnesota. And I would conjecture, because it's more important for some of those folks to go off and do foolish tax cuts that I was a part of well over 15, 17 years ago that put us in an incredible mess and hurt our schools and our children as a result. And my fear is that we're going to repeat that pattern as opposed to learning from the past. And the place to hold the line is precisely in this bill, because this is where the people of Minnesota really step up and talk about who they are, what their values are, what they care about. We care about our young. We care about our future. We know how to smartly invest in them in a way to guarantee our prosperity for generations. There's a lot of good in the bill. The point is, this is not where we ought to be. We ought to be in a much stronger position because we have the resources, we have the political will across the mainstream Minnesotans to do way more than what we're doing in this bill. So, Madam Chair, I will continue to work with you. You've been very good about being accessible on a number of issues. You and I had a good talk about extended time a couple months ago. There's a little pieces here and there I think we can do some really good work on. My big beef is not that. My big beef is the whole setup, the whole cards that this committee was dealt with by the leadership of this institution that frankly is inadequate. And, it's hard to make good stuff out of inadequate cards that they get dealt. So I will be painfully voting no.
Thank you. Other statements? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's often a mistake to follow Representative Mariani because he's so much more articulate than I. You were, again, unfortunately dealt a weak hand by your leadership that has decided to prioritize things like tax credits for gym memberships over adequately funding Minnesota's students. I hope that can change through the process, although I think we're on our first ride through the process. I don't think anyone watching believes that this is that where we're at now is actually going to be anything close to where we're going to end up, and that anybody in your leadership intends this to be anywhere where we end up. I'm just, given where we're starting short on confidence that we will in May or June or July get to a place that's really where Minnesota kids need us to be. I'll speak for myself. I've got a different vision on where we should be going in education than what's reflected in this bill. There are some good things in the bill that, of course, I support, but I think we also need to be looking outside the four walls of a classroom or even the four walls of the school, and certainly outside the four corners of a standardized test. We need to be engaging students and families and teachers and administrators and providing them with the tools and the resources they need to make sure that every kid in Minnesota can succeed. That should mean starting early. But this bill takes almost $20 million out of the early childhood efforts that we've built over the years. It means we need to provide supports for kids, more school counselors. We talk about where Minnesota ranks in the achievement gap. It parallels where we rank in the number of school counselors to students. There might just be a correlation there. We recognize that there's more kids coming in with needs for mental health assistance, but couldn't quite get that into the bill. We need to engage families and communities in evidence-based practices like full-service community schools and education innovation partnerships. And we need to provide more opportunities for academic exploration and engagement through funding better after-school community learning grants. There's a lot more that we can do to support kids and families and teachers and administrators in this bill. Regardless of what's good comes up short. And I will be joining my colleague, Representative Mariani, and I think others in voting no, and urging your leadership to come back with a bill that has a more balanced approach to the state budget and puts the kids of Minnesota at the center and the support and tools that they and their families need immediately around that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Abney. Other comments? Right, members, I want to thank you all for your hard work. And we'll probably still be meeting this session at some point, but you know the bulk of our meetings and that have led up to putting this omnibus bill together. And I just want to thank all of you for your contributions, your questions in committee, the bills you've authored. You know, we strive really hard to make sure that we're making good use of that testimony, of those ideas brought to the committee and incorporating them into the bill. And, you know, I'm pleased with how that has gone. I felt like we've taken really good ideas from the policy committee, from this committee, members, regardless of side of the aisle, and great ideas that were brought forward. So I want to thank all of you for that and for your strong commitment to our students and to the education of them in the state of Minnesota. I know that all of you hold that as a deep and abiding high priority amongst the things that we do here in the legislature. And so I want to thank you for that. With regards to the budget, and obviously there's differences of opinion if you get more than two people together on how you should spend money and what you should allocate for. But I just wanted to highlight what I and hopefully the committee members are feel is important that we've tried to honor in what we're presenting today. This budget does maintain our commitment to focusing new spending on increasing the per pupil formula. And so the largest percent of spending, and I didn't have time to calculate it, but I'm going to guess it's probably close to 90% of the money that we were allocated did go to the per pupil formula. And I've talked to school districts and continue to emphasize that would be my priority, that we are providing money for every student in every district across Minnesota, and that's where we should focus most of our funding. Secondly, we continue our commitment to proven early learning strategies that have become known statewide, nationwide really, as the Minnesota model. Experts in other states are looking at what Minnesota is doing, and then and that was really an approach that was piloted and developed through research of providing targeted support to young children in need through parent-empowered programs. We started down this pathway of scholarships by empowering parents without the financial means to be able to choose quality programs for their students. And I've tried to make sure that we are honing that vision and continuing that through the provisions offered in House File 890. It also continues our commitment to addressing the need for more teachers and more diverse teachers in our classrooms through programs and policy reforms. And again, the Teacher Shortage Act, many provisions from the Teachers of Color Act have been incorporated in this budget. We also continue to fund innovation and put resources into proven strategies and programs that are in our communities from transformation zones to things like Reading Corps and Math Corps, with an excellent track record of making strides for our students and helping them achieve. So this budget is, as all budgets are in the beginning phases, the starting point.
of a conversation that will include now from this committee, the rest of the members of the House, and also will then involve our colleagues in the Senate, and then obviously Governor Dayton, and the commissioner in the department. And I look forward to those conversations in the coming days as we look to find common ground and developing a strong budget emphasizing priority for the education of our students in Minnesota. And with that, I would ask for your support on the bill. All in favor of House File 890 as amended, or no, excuse me, the motion would be that House File 890 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
All right. Motion prevails. And I would also ask that staff be directed to make technical and conforming changes as necessary to the document. With that, I want to thank committee members. I'm sorry I was pressed for time this morning. I was hoping to bring food for you all, but then I thought maybe that would make us go later in the day as we stop to eat. So I will find time to provide food for you at a later date. I promise that's a commitment on the record. But anyway, thank you so much, members. I appreciate the discussion today. We are adjourned.